Good morning, everyone. I think we're ready to start. Hopefully, we'll have as successful a day as we did yesterday, maybe a little bit more relaxed time-wise, and we're not going to go as late as we did yesterday. Just one announcement. If Dr. Jane Morris is in the audience, please go to the back at the welcome desk. There's an emergency message for you there. Two more things. If you could please make sure you fill out your evaluation forms as you're ready to leave today, and to fill out the questionnaire passed along by the Hopkins folks about 6-minute walk distance. So let's get ready to start. I'd like to introduce our two chairpersons today, Dr. Valerie McLaughlin from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and Dr. Hossein Ghofrani from the University Hospital of Gießen in Germany.
Good morning, everybody, to this very early bird session. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Adi Ghofrani from Gießen University, and it's my pleasure to co-chair the session with Valerie McLaughlin, and also looking forward to a very exciting program on new trends and developments in the field of pulmonary hypertension. And I just want to be very brief introducing Ralf Schermuly from our group in Gießen, who will give a talk on the impact of tyrosine kinase inhibitors in pulmonary hypertension.
So thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to present this very interesting topic, which is probably one of the future therapies to treat this severe pulmonary vascular disease. So I think there is now growing evidence that pulmonary hypertension and the remodeling process shares some processes which are known from malignant diseases. And pulmonary hypertension can be maybe regarded as a pseudo-malignant disease, as processes like proliferation or apoptosis resistance, migration, are increased or dysregulated. So the cell types consist of fibroblasts, myocytes, endothelial cells. All of these cells are involved in this process, and they produce extracellular matrix and growth factors, which lead finally to the occlusion of the lumen. And when we now take a look, when we consider pulmonary hypertension as a pseudo-malignant disease, and we now take a look to the current treatment strategies for tumor therapy, we see that the classical tumor therapy consists of three major columns, we say in Germany. So the one is resection, radiation, and chemotherapy. And I think we agree that this is not the first choice to treat pulmonary hypertension. But nevertheless, during the last 5 years, another column established, and this is the inhibition of tyrosine kinases. And there are now several compounds on the market which are used to treat severe malignant diseases. So tyrosine kinases is a very complex family of receptors. So they share common structures. They have an extracellular domain, a transmembrane domain, and the tyrosine kinase domain. And I just picked some examples here. For example, the epidermal growth factor receptor, platelet-derived growth factor receptor, vascular endothelial growth factor receptor, fibroblast growth factor. So it's a huge family of receptor tyrosine kinases which bind on the extracellular domain growth factors or matrix and then transfer the signals in the cell. The final physiological effects in the cell, they are mainly mediated by dimerization of the receptors after binding of the ligand. There is then multiple phosphorylation, autophosphorylation of the tyrosine kinase residue intracellular. And then these receptors operate via different kinases. For example, the MAP kinase pathway or PI3 kinase AKT to induce gene expression, and all of these changes in gene expression will result in a status of increased proliferation, invasion, secretion of growth factors and matrix proteins, migration, and in resistance to apoptotic events. So we started a couple of years ago to investigate or to do microarray experiments on tissue from pulmonary hypertensive subjects, and we were quite interested to find some of tyrosine kinases or growth factors which were upregulated on these arrays. For example, PDGF receptor beta, IGF or fibroblast growth factor receptor 2. Nevertheless, we then took a look, and it was clear and already known from the literature that, for example, platelet-derived growth factor expression is higher in patients with idiopathic pulmonary arterial hypertension. So this was published by Mark and Baer a couple of years ago. So there is the receptor and the ligand upregulated in pulmonary hypertension. And how is PDGF working? So PDGF usually is a dimer, and there are right now four different isoforms known. So this is PDGF A, B, C, and D. And out of these ones, PDGF A and B, they also can form a heterodimer. And there are two receptors known, which is the alpha and the beta receptor as well. The alpha and beta receptor can build a heteromer. And you see the affinities. So PDGFB has a very high affinity to the beta receptor, but also to the alpha and the mixed receptor type, while PDGFA has a high affinity only to the alpha receptor. And the signals which are mediated from PDGF mainly work via the RAS-ERK pathway to induce cell growth, via RAS-SARC to induce migration and chemotaxis, and via PA3-AKT to induce survival signals. And we then went in the literature and talked to the oncologist and the hematologist whether inhibitors for PDGF are available, and finally found imatinib. So imatinib is known as Gleevec or STI-571. So this is a small molecule inhibitor of the ABL kinase, of the BCR-ABL kinase. So this is the primary target for chronic myelomic leukemia. PDGF receptor beta or PDGF receptor in general, and c-KIT. And it's oral bioavailable and approved for chronic myelomic leukemia and gastrointestinal stromal tumors. And we started then to do some cell culture experiments. So these are data from pulmonary arterial smooth muscle cells from rats. And you can see when you stimulate these cells with either PDGFA or with PDGFB, these cells start to proliferate, shown by the thymidine incorporation. And both the PDGFA and PDGFB response can be blocked by imatinib. On the other hand, when you use other stimuli, for example, BFGF, EGF, or IGF, you also can induce proliferation, but this is insensitive against imatinib. So we then did experiments in rats injected with monocrotaline, a pulmonary hypertension model, and we implanted subcutaneously telemetric sensors. So this is shown on this cartoon. So they are implanted subcutaneously. A catheter is forwarded in the right ventricle, and these animals, after surgery, when they are recovered, you can just easy measure wireless via the remote system the hemodynamics without invasive techniques or without any invasive procedure. And you see these are physiological pressures of the right ventricle. Then we injected monocrotaline, and over time they developed severe pulmonary hypertension. And in a curative approach, we started treatment with Gleevec 4 weeks after injection of monocrotaline, and could really nearly reverse the pulmonary hypertensive disease in these animals. And of course, we have shown, to give some clinical evidence, we investigated the PDGF-beta receptor expression in human tissue from patients with IPAH. And it is very clear that the PDGF receptor beta is upregulated versus healthy donor tissue, which stimulated us to go further into this subject. So to further prove that PDGF receptor beta is critically involved in this in pulmonary hypertension, we initiated a collaboration with the Cancer Research Centrum in Uppsala in Sweden, or the Karolinska Institute, where we got animals which carry a constitutive active PDGF receptor. And so these animals have a constitutive active PDGF beta receptor, and when you investigate these animals by right-heart catheter, you see that under control conditions, there is no pulmonary hypertension. When you place the wild-type animals in hypoxia for 3 weeks, 10%, they develop pulmonary hypertension. You can reverse pulmonary hypertension in part by imatinib. When you take these PDGF transgene animals, they develop a slightly increased pulmonary hypertension, and again, it is sensitive to imatinib. Very interesting, when we investigated the degree of muscularization of small pulmonary arteries, we found that, and this is now a complex graph, but I think this is generally accepted how to quantify the degree of muscularization. So we count the vessels at a diameter of 20 to 70 micrometer and look whether they are non, partially, or fully muscularized. And you can see here that usually the wild type and the knock-in animals share a similar profile. The major proportion of pulmonary arteries is non or partial muscularized, and there is virtually no muscularization of the small pulmonary arteries. When you place a wild type under hypoxia, you see this characteristic change of a reduction in non-muscularized and increase in partial and fully muscularized pulmonary arteries. And it was quite interesting to see that the knock-in animals, that they develop more severe muscularization of small resistance pulmonary arteries, which again was reversible by treatment of these animals with imatinib. So there is good evidence that PDGF is involved in this process, and I think we are aware of Adi's case report from 2005 from a single patient which deteriorated under maximal therapy. So this patient received inhaled iloprost, sildenafil, and bosentan, and still was on worsened his condition. You see the increase in the functional class, this increase in pulmonary vascular resistance, and a decrease in the 6-minute walking distance. And at this time point, it was decided to add imatinib at 200 milligram per day to the therapy. And during the next 6 months, the functional class improved, pulmonary vascular resistance dropped, and the 6-minute walk distance increased. And this patient is now under treatment for 1 year, for 2 years, and there are now 2-year data available, which clearly show that he still is on a good way. And there are now two other cases shown this year who did a treatment with imatinib in patients with pulmonary hypertension. So Herb Faber's group showed that the pulmonary vascular resistance is going down and there is an increase in cardiac index under imatinib treatment. And similar results were shown from the French group around Gérard Simoneau and Marc Humbert, who show that cardiac index increases under imatinib treatment. And these were patients which were treated for CML with imatinib and had pulmonary hypertension. So everything is okay. Everything is fine. We have shown it in experimental setup. It's now in the clinic. So we can ask ourselves, is it the end? No, for sure not. There are some open issues which have to be discussed, and some of these were already mentioned yesterday. So it is still important to discuss what is the role of c-KIT in pulmonary hypertension, because it is a target of imatinib as well. We have to ask ourselves whether the Abl kinase is involved in the effects of imatinib. We have to think about what kind of biomarkers predict the response to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And, of course, is imatinib the right drug? Maybe there are other tyrosine kinase inhibitors which are more potent. And finally, randomized controlled trials have to show the efficacy of such a new therapy. I just want to go some information about the other potential targets. So these are the IC50 values of imatinib against BCR-ABL, the PDGF receptor, and c-KIT. And you see there is virtually no difference in the IC50. And it is quite interesting to see. So these are stainings against c-KIT. And we see cells surrounding the vessel, which are c-KIT positive, as well as some positive staining in the smooth muscle layer. So there are inflammatory cells or other cells which are c-KIT positive surrounding the pulmonary artery. And Marc Humbert very recently, he suggested, he has shown that dendritic cells are sitting around the vasculature. And it is well known that dendritic cells are c-KIT positive and that the function of dendritic cell can be modulated by imatinib. So this is something which is very interesting, and we have to think about whether these cells are a good target for to block them or to stimulate them. The kinase, the Abl kinase, is very, very interesting as well. So Abl is downstream of the Src kinase, which is inhibited by the BMPR2 receptor, which we know is downregulated in pulmonary hypertension. Src is downstream of NADPH oxidases. It can be activated by the 5-HT receptor or the angiotensin receptors, and this then influences Abl function and phosphorylates Abl. Abl itself can transactivate EGF receptor or the PDGF receptor, which means we have a loop which is continuously going on. And the question is whether inhibition here has a protective effect. And a very, very interesting field is the search for a good biomarker. And again, we took a look to the field of oncology, and they are very, very far away, and I think the field of pulmonary hypertension has really to invest more energy to find good biomarkers. So, for example, these are data from CD34 phosphotyrosine positive cells, which predict in oncology a good response to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And we are going now to analyze these cells and analyze circulating endothelial progenitor cells, whether we get a good feeling if these patients probably have a very good response to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. On the other hand, the right ventricle is very, very interesting, and I think it's not possible, and we are all thinking about is to get lung biopsies to investigate the pulmonary vasculature. Now, this is nearly impossible, but we are trying to get right ventricular myocardial biopsies to do differential display analysis, maybe find some genes which predict a very good response to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And coming now to a very interesting paper which appeared in the last month. So the question arose whether imatinib may have cardiotoxic effects. And this was a report from the Boston group which showed in neonatal cardiomyocytes of mice that when you incubate these cells with imatinib, they underwent apoptosis and a cell death. On the other hand, they treated mice with imatinib and investigated similar effects in the intact heart. And they presented data of 10 patients which were positive for, or which are suffering from CML and underwent treatment with imatinib, which developed left ventricular failure over time. So to summarize my ideas about this is that this is, of course, a well-designed experimental study which describes the role of the ABL kinase, and this was the mainly target of imatinib, which has to be shown or to mediate these cardiotoxic effects, which very nicely show the effects of the ABL kinase in neonatal mouse cardiomyocytes. The clinical part describes 10 patients out of a huge amount of patients which were treated for CML with imatinib and which presented with cardiomyopathy. From these 10 patients, two biopsy data were presented demonstrating that ABL kinase is involved in these cardiotoxic effects. Nevertheless, there are clear limitations of this study. So there is, of course, no sufficient information about the patient selection criteria. So these were 10 out of a huge collective. I think it is even possible to find 10 patients which maybe improve the left ventricular function. There are no sufficient information about exclusion of other potential factors, chemotherapy, viral myocarditis, dilative cardiomyopathy, and the dosing which was chosen in the animals was quite high. So they used 200 milligram per kilogram. You see it translates in a reasonable amount in humans. From my experience, which I have from these mice, 100 milligram per kilogram for 2 weeks was on the border of tolerance. So 200 milligram over 5 weeks is really a really high dose. Nevertheless, there is now close monitoring of cardiac function is mandatory. So I will speed up a little bit. So what about other tyrosine kinase inhibitors? There are non-specific inhibitors now on the market, like sorafenib or sunitinib. There are inhibitors which are selective against c-KIT, some of them which have a higher potential against PDGF receptor, or which include a component of the VEGF receptor. And sorafenib is quite an interesting compound. It's developed from Onyx and Bayer. It's oral available and blocks multi-kinases. And of course, last year it was approved for renal cell carcinoma. And during the American Heart this year, first data were presented showing that sorafenib is has a very good potential in the hypoxia-induced pulmonary hypertension in rats, so an experimental study. So we did some experiments in monocotyline rats, and again we could show that sorafenib dose-dependently had very nice effects on the hemodynamics and on the right heart hypertrophy. And but you have to take or to keep in mind that sorafenib is an VEGF inhibitor as well, and we know from Norbert Völger and Robin Tudor that VEGF is an important maintenance factor in the lung. So on the one hand, there is a loop which VEGF produces prostacyclin, which again stabilizes VEGF, and chronic VEGF inhibition by small molecule inhibitors causes emphysema. So this is something which we have to answer in future, whether a chronic VEGF inhibition may result in emphysema formation in patients. So to summarize, the tyrosine kinase inhibitors have demonstrated preclinical efficacy. Imatinib operates via PDGF in clinical pulmonary hypertension. We have to think about the role of c-KIT and ABL kinase. The randomized controlled trials are underway, and we have to think about maybe other tyrosine kinases for future. Last but not least, I want to thank our big group. You see here, this was a picture from our last retreat. So these are the PhD students which are working in Gießen. And of course, I want to thank Werner Friedrich Grimminger and Werner Seeger, as well Norbert Weissmann and Adi Gofrani. And finally, thank you for your attention.
That was a wonderful presentation. It's very interesting. We are running a little behind, but luckily, one speaker is not going to be in attendance, so we are going to take some questions. Steve?
Hi, Steve Kaywood from Columbia. Very nice talk. We have a paper coming out that looked at PDGF expression in pulmonary capillary hemangiomatosis. We found upregulation both of the PDGF molecule as well as the beta receptor. My question was, do you have any data on PDGF expression in these patients? And any clinical experience with using Gleevec in a patient with capillary hemangiomatosis?
Mm. So, unfortunately, I don't have I have data of the PDGF receptor expression. Nevertheless, when you have these characteristic phenotypical changes of media hypertrophy and smooth muscle cells, which are in a very activated state, I think PDGF receptor is upregulated. Yeah.
David?
Langley McGill University, very nice presentation. Do you see differences between various types of PAH? I'm asking because in New England in the last year, there was a suggestion that patients with scleroderma have an auto-stimulatory antibody to the PDGF receptor. And I'm just wondering whether they respond better to Gleevec than other groups. Yeah. Have you looked at that?
So, of course, this was a very stimulating paper in New England, and we have currently established this assay because this is exactly the question we want to answer. So I'm not aware about the details of the clinical trial which is underway. So at least from the experimental side, I know that in hypoxic mice and in monocotyline rats, so two stimuli, two species, finally the mechanism work. So I think this is something which we will answer in future.
Stephen Archer, Edmonton. It was a very nice presentation. On the FORCE paper, the one in Nature Medicine, one of the bottom line in their abstract, I think there is an element of credibility there because what they're saying is the mitochondria is depolarizing, and thus far, at least in the work that Evangelos Michalakis and I have done, almost all the therapeutic agents that we found that regress pulmonary hypertension do depolarize the mitochondrial membrane potential. And the same mechanism that FORCE postulates, that that then causes the release of cytochrome C into the cytosol and triggers apoptosis, which is a good thing if you're trying to regress pulmonary hypertension, is a bad thing if it's happening in the heart. So there is some way that that might, in fact, be true. And just a comment, the other thing is there's an old paper by Fox and DiCarletto in Nature like about 20 years ago showing that a really good PDGF inhibitor is fish oil. And I know Ken Weir and I use that, and fish oil does seem to cause decrease in pulmonary hypertension. So there may be even less toxic PDGF inhibitors out there.
Okay. Thanks.
Morali?
Just a question. Enjoyed your presentation, as always. The in your early clinical experience, either you or Dr. Gofrani, can you comment maybe just on the durability of the benefit of Gleevec in patients, meaning, you know, have you had cases where people had a nice response and then maybe 6 months, a year down the road, really started falling off again? And where I'm going with this is there any concern of either some type of development of resistance, for lack of a better word, as some of the oncologists have seen with CML and using this drug?
Yeah, of course. So this is an issue which is critical for treatment of CML, that there is kind of resistance development. I think this is even a niche where other tyrosine kinases inhibitors are now going in. Whether such a phenomenon is true for a pulmonary vascular disease, I don't know right now. It's still open.
So maybe I comment on that. With the limited experience we have in patients that were treated on compassionate treatment basis, I would say in that period of time that we are overlooking these patients, there is no clear signal of desensitization or resistance development. But I think time frames of, let's say, 2 years are too short to conclusively judge on that issue. The trial is now ongoing. It's recruiting quite well. It's halfway with recruitment, this early phase two trial. So we'll know by end of next year whether it's safe and efficacious, and if so, there will be a phase three trial which assesses efficacy, and then obviously also long-term treatment. But you're right to say, and we saw yesterday on Norbert Werkel's intriguing slide that we know from the oncology field that there is a selection pressure and a desensitization issue, at least in CML.
Okay. That's great. Thank you so much, Ralph. It's my pleasure to introduce the next speaker, Augustine Choi from the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Dr. Choi's topic is carbon monoxide gas.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Roberto Machado, Mark Gladwin, and the committee to invite a non-PH person to the podium. And I guess we make a little switch from receptor-mediated process to a gaseous molecule. And I guess the era of gaseous molecules started about 20 years ago when we discovered that EDRF is really a gaseous molecule, nitric oxide. Ironically, though, we have known for a longer time that we also generate another endogenous gaseous molecule, which is CO. And to get everyone on the same page, I have to show you this slide of how CO is produced in our cells, tissues, and body. And it's through the enzyme called heme oxygenase system. And HO1 or HO2, which is a constitutive isoenzyme, breaks down heme. And it's a rate-limiting enzyme that breaks down heme, which produces biliverdin, which quickly gets degraded to bilirubin by biliverdin reductase. And with equimolar breakdown of heme, we have production or release of free iron from the breakdown of heme, which gets sequestered into ferritin very promptly in cells. And, of course, you have production of carbon monoxide. Now, just one slide on regulation of HO1, because it's really the major way to produce CO in our cells, tissues, and body, which is through HO1. And I won't go through any in great detail, but this is a slide, I think, demonstrating about 20 years of work from the literature. And it's truly a stress-inducible gene product. Maheen Mains, one of the pioneers in this field, recently wrote a book describing that more than 100 compounds increases HO1 more than tenfold at the mRNA level, which truly, I think, can be regarded as one of the most sensitive or inducible gene products. The regulation is quite complex. The take-home message here is the HO1 is generally regulated at a gene transcription level. And depending on the stimulus, whether it's ROS, generating systems, growth factors, heavy metals, and what have you, depending on the stimulus, the induction of HO1 is regulated by various different transcription factors. But the key transcription factor that HO1 is regulated by is the NRF2 family. And of course, all of you know this is a very exciting transcription factor that's regulated by an inhibitor, KEAP1 and BOC1. Now, in hypoxia, to keep in the theme of this conference, it's been shown that the HIF, the hypoxia inducible factor, regulates hypoxia-induced HO1 gene expression. Since that report, there's been other reports that other transcription factors may involve regulating hypoxia-induced HO1 expression. So enough of expression studies, and we got into this field about 10 years ago in terms of HO1, and initially we spent time looking at how the function of HO1 is in various models of tissue injury. And we do mostly lung injury models, and we started off with hyperoxic injury, and these are really old studies, but I thought it was important to go over, and Patty Lee and others showed that if you overexpress HO1 in cells or if you give HO1 by gene transfer, you can confer potent cytoprotection against tissue injury. Of course, the knockout was performed by Ken Paz and Tonagawa, and consistent with HO1 being a protective molecule against oxidative stress, the HO1 knockout mice were more susceptible against oxidative stress. Now, in the last 5-6 years, there's been accumulating evidence that CO is indeed a very potent signaling molecule in inducing cytoprotection. And this is just a summary cartoon that I made. It has potent anti-apoptotic effects, potent anti-inflammatory effects, potent anti-proliferative effects. And in terms of tissue remodeling and PAH, or for that matter, any lung injury models, these obviously are very important processes that you need to regulate and protect. So I'll start off with just one slide on the potent effects of CO in protection against inflammatory process. And this is a summary of works by our lab and others showing that CO is really an interesting signaling molecule that induces cytoprotection by being a very potent anti-inflammatory molecule. In macrophages, we have shown that CO's anti-inflammatory effects requires the MAP kinase pathway, in particular the P38-MKK3 pathway. Brian Zuckerbraun, our lab, and Tim Billier, Leo Ottobine, and others have shown that in hepatocytes, CO needs the activation of NF-kappa-B, iNOS, and also HO1 in inducing anti-inflammatory effects. And we have recently shown that CO also in endothelial cells requires the downstream heat shock factor and heat shock protein, in particular heat shock protein 70, in conferring anti-inflammatory effects. So the take-home, and of course in some cells like fibroblasts, the conventional dogma that CO signaling is through cyclic GMP is still intact, and it requires cyclic GMP. So the take-home message here is that depending on cell types, depending on tissue injury models, CO signals through specific signaling pathways. So in terms of vascular injury, this is reported 3 years ago. This is a collaboration of many laboratories, Brian Zuckerbraun, Tim Billier, Leo Ottobine, Shin Kano, and our laboratory. And we basically use a very simple model. All of you know this model, the carotid balloon angioplasty model in the carotid artery. And we administered 250 ppm CO initially for the duration of the study, which was 2 weeks. And we saw significant protection against intimal hyperplasia. And subsequently, we did some kinetic studies based on the fact that on one weekend, Friday, we ran out of our CO gas tank, and we had to cut short. And surprisingly, and what we reported here after really firm confirmation, was that we could give CO for 1 hour at 250 ppm for 2 weeks and saw the exact same protection as you would have if you've done it for the 14 days duration. And I'll touch upon that when we get to the data relevant to PAH. And the mechanism of this, this has been published, so I won't go through it, but one mechanism is that CO has potent anti-proliferative effects in vascular smooth muscle cells, and the pathway is described here using inhibitory chemical inhibition and genetic inhibition. We showed that CO requires both cyclic GMP first, which then can activate P38 and downstream P21 to induce anti-proliferation of vascular smooth muscle cells. Subsequent study to that, Dr. Kim, Hongpyo Kim, a visiting research scientist from Korea in our laboratory, showed that, interestingly, CO requires CAV1 for its protection. Using the same model, we saw that CO increases expression of calveolin-1, as you see here, and this was published, I won't go through it, but in vitro, he saw similar observations. And using sRNA in cells, basically showing that the downregulation of CAV1 abolishes the anti-proliferative effects of CO. Currently in our laboratory, we're really looking at the mechanism of how the absence of calveolin-1 ablates the protective effects of CO. So how about pulmonary artery hypertension? Well, I think the field really got a jump start back in 1999 and 2000 when several seminal papers were published in the role of heme oxygenase in models of PAH. Dr. Yet and Dr. Lee and others showed that the HO1 knockout mice had maladaptive response to chronic hypoxia, induced pulmonary hypertension. These HO1 knockout mice had increased RV dilatation, RV infarction, and it really set the tone for HO1 in PAH. Of course, Dr. Kurumbanus' lab published two very nice papers showing that if you induce endogenous levels of HO1, either chemically by heman or nickel here, you can protect against hypoxia vascular remodeling. And of course, if you do it genetically, if you use transgenic mice that constitutively express HO1 in the lung, it protects against pulmonary inflammation, PAH, and vessel wall hypertrophy. So we have known for a long time, although it's not as potent as nitric oxide, that CO decreases pulmonary artery vascular resistance in a variety of different animal models. And of course, the effects of CO in vascular cells, and Dr. Kurumbanus really led the way in this area. There was cyclic GMP dependent primarily, but recently there's been some reports that it can be independent. So the hypothesis is very simple. Can we, if there were three very nice papers showing that HO1 is important in protection against models of hypoxia-induced pulmonary hypertension, how about then the byproduct, the gaseous molecule CO? So the hypothesis is that delivery of CO may prevent or reverse experimental PAH. So the model is very simple. This work was done by several laboratories. Shin Kano led the way, Leo Ottobine, Brian Zuckerbrown, Tim Billier, and our lab. And using monoclonal model first, a rat model that all of you know, and the experiment was not just to see the protection of CO, because by now we have seen when other laboratories have reported that CO is cytoprotected in a variety of models, and we were not so interested in just another paper showing the protection. But we were just curious with the question whether CO can reverse or maybe even therapeutically, given therapeutically, can reverse the injury model. So again, monoclonal injection here, one-time dose, and we gave them CO at 250 ppm, 1 hour a day. We didn't do the whole duration, and based on the study published 3 years ago in Nature Medicine. So we gave 1 hour a day for 2 weeks, which is reasonable. We just have to get technicians to come in to replace the tanks on Saturday and Sunday, which can be a chore. And 2 weeks, so this is a study, 2 weeks, another set of animals. After 2 weeks of MCT, giving CO 1 hour a day for 2 weeks, and then at the very end, the last 2 weeks of MCT. So let me show you some data, and this was recently published in JXMed, so I'll just go through it. So again, a well-known model that if you give MCT, you get increased pulmonary hypertension. And the first data point really didn't surprise us so much, because we've seen this in other models, that CO 1 hour a day for the first 2 weeks, and then, of course, we processed the sample 6 weeks later, we saw significant reduction of pulmonary artery pressure. When we gave CO in the in day 15 to day 28 only, we saw very similar effects. And of course, and this really was a very nice, pleasant surprise to us, that if you give inhaled CO at the day 29 to day 42 of a six-week model, we saw very similar effects in terms of pulmonary artery pressure. And how about RV-LV ratio? Again, very simple, superimposable sort of trends here. Histologically, this is what we see. This is truly not a representative field. This is truly what we have seen. MCT well-described, animals that receive inhaled CO. Wall thickness, same story here, just showing you one time point. And this is a table which summarizes the whole study. CO given days day 1 to 14, 15 to 28, 29 to 42 in a six-week model. And the asterisks here, whether it's mean arterial pressure, RV mass, the RV LV ratio, in all of these samples, CO has significant attenuation of the markers here. And they were not very different whether you gave CO early on, middle, or later on. So that was MCT, and I know in this field that a lot of people don't like MCT models, so we switched to a chronic hypoxia model, which I don't have to describe for this audience. Again, we didn't do as detailed of kinetics as we did for MCT, but again, starting with chronic hypoxia, and 3 weeks later, and all as all of you know, 3 weeks into the 10% O2 exposure, the animals, the mice are really developing, you start seeing increased indices of pulmonary hypertension. And we gave CO the last 3 weeks, again, 1 hour a day. And this is the data, mean arterial pressure, of course, induced by hypoxia, CO brings it down. RV-LV ratio, again, hypoxia brings it up, CO brings it down. So what is the mechanism of how CO perhaps is doing this? And we still don't know the final answer, but we started doing that in this study, looking at processes important tissue remodeling. We don't think this is CO vasodilatation effects is doing this. So we looked at basic markers of proliferation or apoptosis, cell death, if you will. And not surprisingly, in the KI-67 staining, consistent with the published reports that CO is anti-proliferative, we saw the CO really decrease KI-67 staining. Interestingly, though, if you do markers of tunnel or apoptotic, CO-induced cell death, which is a good way to explain the results we are seeing, because we are seeing that CO can reverse hypoxia or MCT-induced pulmonary hypertension. But in other models, CO is usually an anti-apoptotic molecule, especially in inflammatory process. So furthermore, then, to look at this more mechanistically, we took the known dogma or observations that is known in the literature that decreased ENaS expression may play a role in a human PAH. If you disrupt ENaS, you get increased PAP in animal models. And of course, we all know we give inhaled NO clinically, both to adults and younger children with varying results. So the hypothesis here is, again, is CO's protection involving the NOS pathway. And this is the data, again, in tissue at hypoxia. We get very increased ENOS staining in the vasculature after CO and hypoxia compared to hypoxia or air alone. And, of course, that was in vivo. In vitro, CO can induce very nice levels of protein expression, ENOS, in a time-dependent manner. You would not expect to see much ENOS induction in endothelial cells. So the functional studies were done here. The obvious experiment to do is take ENOS knockout mice, do the same hypoxia model. Again, what you see here in wild-type mice, you get very nice protection using RV pressure as one indices, and in the ENOS knockouts, CO could not protect in ENOS knockout mice from hypoxia-induced PAH. So the summary of the data here is 1 hour of inhaled CO per day can reverse experimental PAH, And we think this has significant therapeutic implications, hopefully, in the future. The mechanism of that is not known, but perhaps it's through the negative remodeling that that we saw in this study in the pulmonary vasculature. And the protection is dependent in part on ENOS expression. So the conclusion is that perhaps that CO can be a useful therapeutic for PAH, and Roberto Machado, Mark Gladwin, and we hope to collaborate. And I thank Mark and Roberto publicly for that, for giving us the opportunity to perhaps test this in human PAH. We don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but perhaps in a year or two. And, of course, we really have to continue to study not only safety but mechanistic investigations to give us a clue in how we can use the signaling pathways of CO to perhaps mimic the protection that we have seen here. And I guess my conclusion slide. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for sharing this very intriguing results with us. First questions from the audience.
Augustine, very nice. A comment and a question. One comment is that Connie Noguchi has shown that EPO in hypoxic endothelial cells can drive ENOS, and whether some of this is via normoxic hypoxic signaling and driving erythropoietin to stimulate ENOS. Maybe comments on that. And the second question, which I know there's no good answer for at this point, but maybe you've thought more about this, and that is that this obviously isn't a radical, so it's a very unreactive molecule, and so it must be targeting hemes to transduce signal. And what are these heme targets, and how might this be happening, unless you think there might be chemistry involved?
Sure. Well, the first part, the EPO thing, I think that's a great idea, Mark, and we've had some informal discussions about that, and that's really uncharted territory, and someone should look at that in a rigorous way. In terms of the second question, I think that's really one of the critical questions in CO signaling. We know that heme is the only substrate. We know that it binds very avidly. There are many heme-containing proteins, catalases, many cytochrome molecules. And we've started to look into that, but there's data now from many laboratories that perhaps the CO signaling and CO's function is through non-heme-mediated pathways. You know, the fact that the MAP kinases are very nicely activated. Well, how is a kinase activated by an inert gas like CO? Well, there's some data suggesting it may be through the production of ROS, mitochondrial-dependent. Perhaps ROS is the, in fact, there's three papers now showing that in macrophages that CO can induce ROS production in cells. Now, in some cell types, CO decreases ROS. It's a very complex question whether it's mitochondrial drive ROS or NADPH drive ROS. So I just lay out ROS as one potential mechanism of how CO could be mediating the non-heme mediated functions. Yes,
Shelley.
Hi. There are two clinical models of high levels of carbon monoxide. One would be the something like sickle cell, where there's a high turnover of red cells, or thal for that matter, and also smokers. So I wonder, what are the levels of carbon monoxide in those patients? Because those are people who end up with pulmonary hypertension yet have CO levels.
Sure. Well, using just 1 hour data, you know, we know that we really, if CO is ever going to be used clinically, we can't really bump more than carboxyhemoglobin about 10 or so. And I think the one-hour exposure experiments is critical because prior to those experiments, we were doing the duration of experiments, and we were achieving carboxyhemoglobin in the 20 range, which obviously will not be used clinically. But if you give 1 hour, you achieve in the low teens, and as you know, the half-life of carboxyhemoglobin is very quick, very fast, so we feel that 1 hour a day continuously is something that perhaps patients can tolerate. Now, you bring up a very good point. In patients with end-stage PAH, they're really hypoxic. So those are the issues that Roberto and Mark and I are dealing with. And I think we'll probably start off with a sort of a salvage or compassionate use kind of for really severe end-stage PA patients, if we can get to that stage.
Thank you very much. And now it's a very great pleasure to invite one of the directors of this symposium, Dr. Mark Gladwin, to report about therapy with nitride.
Thank you and good morning. Thank you. Today I'd like to talk about the emerging biology of nitrite in signaling hypoxic vasodilation and cytoprotection and the possibility that this could be harnessed as a therapy for pulmonary hypertension. By way of disclosures, as a government employee, they keep me poor and unhindered by conflicts of interest, but I am an inventor on an NIH provisional patent for the use of nitrite salts for therapeutics. So, under normal physiology, nitric oxide is produced by endothelial cells via the enzyme nitric oxide synthase, and it converts arginine to citrulline. Nitric oxide is a paracrine vasodilator in that it diffuses from endothelium to smooth muscle and activates guanylate cyclase. The scavenging reactions of nitric oxide that you heard so much about yesterday in sickle cell disease are limited because hemoglobin is compartmentalized within red cells, and this creates major diffusional barriers for NO, the unstirred layer around the red cell, the cell-free zone, and laminar flowing blood that reduces the reactivity of NO with intracellular hemoglobin by about 1,000-fold. As you heard yesterday with hemolysis, these diffusional barriers are disrupted, and we disrupt NO-dependent homeostasis. I'd like to talk about a very controversial area, but very interesting area, and that's the possibility that in addition to being a paracrine vasodilator, nitric oxide has endocrine vasodilator activities, that it can be stabilized in blood by forming other species that can regulate endocrine NO homeostasis. This field was launched by Les Calza's group, who suggested that NO could bind to albumin to form snow albumin, advanced by Stamler, Jonathan Stamler at Duke, suggesting that NO could covalently bind to the cysteine 93 of hemoglobin to form snow hemoglobin. And we find support for this principle. However, we believe that the storage reservoir in the mediator is the simple, ubiquitous anion nitrite, same nitrite that's in hot dogs and cured meat, and that this can be reduced to NO along the physiologic oxygen gradient. So the question we asked to start this work was, is nitrite an intrinsic vasodilator? And nitrite is just considered to be an oxidation byproduct of NO that's considered to be inert. And I'll mention why shortly. But we looked at this in a series of experiments in collaboration with Richard Cannon in the NHLBI over the last 5 years. We infused nitrite into the brachial artery of normal human volunteers, and we infused near physiologic levels. So in these experiments shown here, infusing nitrite into the brachial artery, the levels coming out of the anticubital vein were 2.5 micromolar. And during exercise, only 900 nanomolar, really at the near physiologic level. So we were quite surprised at this time when we found that 10 out of 10 normal volunteers vasodilated, even at these low levels. We saw vasodilation at rest, during nitric oxide synthase inhibition with LNMMA, and during exercise, despite the levels only being 900 nanomolar during exercise stress. So how does nitrite vasodilate? And a hint was that as we infuse nitrite, despite the very short AV transit time of less than 10 seconds, these are regional infusions in the forearm, we saw an increase in NO-modified hemoglobin, namely the NO bound to the heme, iron nitrosyl hemoglobin, and to a lesser extent, NO bound to the cysteine 93, snow hemoglobin. And with exercise, there was a dramatic increase in the rate of NO binding to the heme, or the formation of NO bound to heme. When we looked at all conditions in 18 volunteers, at rest, with exercise stress, and we correlated the amount of NO heme that formed, it was inversely proportional to the anticubital vein hemoglobin oxygen saturation. The lower the saturation, the more NO was forming. And this brought us to the work of Michael Doyle, who published this paper in JBC in 1981. He's now the chair of biochemistry at Maryland. And he described that nitrite will react with deoxyhemoglobin, i.e. deoxyhemoglobin has a nitrite reductase activity, and a proton to generate methemoglobin and NO. This NO can then bind to a vicinal deoxyhemoglobin, forming the NO heme, or iron nitrosyl hemoglobin, that we hypothesized we were measuring as a dosimeter of the rate of this in vivo reaction. Now, this is a simple equation, but we were struck by the potential physiologic significance. It requires nitrite, which is a ubiquitous contaminant, so to speak, of our blood, our tissues. It requires deoxyhemoglobin, so it has hypoxia sensor chemistry. It requires a proton, so it has pH sensor chemistry. It generates methemoglobin, and this won't scavenge NO within that heme pocket, so there's an opportunity for diffusional escape. And it generates NO, one of the most potent vasodilators known. So we hypothesized that a three-component system of hypoxia, nitrite, and the red cells could regulate hypoxic vasodilation. To summarize a lot of data, one of the ways we tested this was by looking at aryl green bioassays in collaboration with Rakesh Patel at UAB. And I'll just mention that in 1952, Fritsch Gott, who later won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of nitric oxide, validated the aortic ring bioassay in rabbits using nitrite as his vasodilator. However, the concentration of nitrite required to vasodilate a rabbit aortic ring at room oxygen with buffer, the EC50 was 100 micromolar. And this low potency is the reason that nitrite was really dismissed as a physiologically functioning molecule. So we asked a different question. We said, well, what happens if you add red cells to your aortic ring system? And what happens if we deoxygenate these red cells? So first of all, on the left, we reproduce the work of Fritsch Gott from 1952. He got the exact same traces. This is vessel tension from tense to relaxed, and this is nitrite concentration. And as you can see, our EC50 is about 100 micromolar nitrite. And at the physiologically relevant ranges over here of nitrite, there's no vasoactivity. But look what happens when we add red cells and we deoxygenate in this experiment. 60 millimeters of mercury, 25, 15. There's a leftward potentiation, and we now begin to see relaxation in the nanomolar concentration range. And in a lot of chemistry work that we've performed over the last 2 years, we've discovered that hemoglobin actually is an allosterically regulated nitrite reductase, in that as you increase oxygen saturation to 100% or you deoxygenate down to 0%, you modulate the rate of nitrite reduction. And what happens is you oxygenate your hemoglobin, your concentration of deoxyheme drops so that your substrate for nitrite binding drops, so that would drop your rate of your reaction. But interestingly, as hemoglobin oxygenates, the redox potential of the heme decreases. It becomes a better electron donor to nitrite. So the intrinsic reactivity characterized by the bimolecular rate constant increases exponentially. And for any reaction, the product of your reactant concentration, deoxyhemoglobin, times your bimolecular rate gives you your rate. So interestingly, for hemoglobin, the maximal rate of nitrite reduction occurs at the intrinsic P50, or around the 50% sat point. And this is experimentally shown here with oxygen-saturated hemoglobin, looking at rates of nitrite reduction, and you can see there's a peak rate around 50% saturation. So in summary for this background, this data suggests that hemoglobin is an allosterically regulated nitrite reductase with maximal NO-generating enzymatic activity at the R to T deoxy transition. This reaction produces NO under allosteric control, and a maximal rate of nitrite reduction at P50 would be ideal for hypoxic vasodilation and hypoxic signaling. So we asked the question, is it possible that nitrite could be used therapeutically? And we say back to the future, because as you know, nitrite's a principal ingredient in the antidote for cyanide poisoning. It's been used for more than 100 years, but at very high concentrations. So we considered very simply, under what conditions, human conditions or human diseases, does oxygen drop, does pH drop, there's vascular complications or constriction, and NO might be beneficial. And we've looked at vasospasm after subarachnoid hemorrhage, and we see potent effects in primates. We've looked a lot at ischemia reperfusion injury, heart, liver, et cetera. Others have published in brain. It appears to limit ischemia reperfusion of those organs. And I'll share with you data on pulmonary hypertension. We started in a collaboration with Loma Linda because Christian Hunter was a student in my lab. And we started with the question, and he came from Loma Linda. We asked the question, what about persistent pulmonary hypertension in the newborn? As you know, this is a condition where there's elevated pulmonary vascular resistance to the point that venous blood becomes diverted through fetal channels, through patent foramen ovale, through the ductus arteriosus, so that you get right-to-left shunting and systemic hypoxemia. And interestingly, if you look at mean hemoglobin oxygen saturations in the nitric oxide trials, they were about 55% in subjects prior to enrollment on NO, which is right at our theoretical maximal nitrate reductase activity range. So in this disease, there's hypoxia. This triggers vasoconstriction, more hypoxia, more vasoconstriction, and a spiral, unless unchecked, to death. And there's a number of drugs that are pulmonary vasodilators that have been used to target the vasoconstriction, sildenafil, inhaled NO. And there's a number of pulmonary-based strategies, such as surfactant, to improve the hypoxemia. So our first hypothesis is inhaled nitrite, just simple nitrite, a pulmonary vasodilator? Again, will nitrite inhalation result in the generation of NO that could regulate this process? So we use the hypoxic newborn lamb model that's anesthetized and ventilated. And as opposed to a $100,000 nitric oxide delivery system, we took an albuterol neb, connected to the inline circuit, mixed nitrite from Sigma, which most of you have in your lab, into buffer, and just nebulized it. And we gave 50 milligrams per minute for 20 minutes, according to this protocol, hypoxia, nitrite for 20 minutes versus saline, randomizing the order. And in this model, the hypoxia is shown as light gray. Pulmonary pressures are shown here. Here's the saline nebulization control. There's no change in pulmonary pressure, no change in systemic pressure, no change in exhaled NO. And again, in these experiments, we're clamping the oxygen at 50 torr. This is what nitrite did. There's an immediate vasodilation of the pulmonary vasculature that's very reproducible. There's a slight but not significant decrease in systemic pressure, so most of the nitrite is contained in the lung vasculature. And remarkably, the host-nitrite interaction generates exhaled NO gas. And again, this is just summation data on pulmonary pressure, systemic blood pressure, and exhaled nitric oxide. So is this effect potentiated by hypoxia, which is our model? And so to test this, we compared the hypoxic vasodilation to normoxic. In fact, these were hyperoxic experiments using an infusion of thromboxane. And this, again, for comparison, is the nitrite nebulization data. And these are the thromboxane data. And by the way, for both experiments, it's 15 mg per minute for 20 minutes. You see that there's a blunted vasodilatory response during normoxia. These are systemic vasodilations. And there's an increase in exhaled NO, although the extent is less. And this is the direct comparison, thromboxane to hypoxia vasodilation, change in exhaled NO, and formation of NO heme, or iron nitrosyl hemoglobin, which I'll show you here. We've measured by electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy. There's a very specific signature of NO bound to the heme group because it's a paramagnetic species. So under normoxia, the blood levels of iron nitrosyl are shown in green, and under hypoxia are shown in blue, and the amplitude and AUC for this spectral signature is increased. And this is just the quantification of the amount so that there's more NO generation during hypoxia. We next wanted to compare the efficacy with authentic NO gas. And for this, and we also wanted to look how long does the nitrite effect last within the limits of this experiment. You can't keep these baby sheep hypoxic for too long. The model becomes unstable. And here's inhaled NO. It's a very potent vasodilation. It's a more profound vasodilation than nitrite. I mean, a more complete vasodilation. But as soon as you stop it, you rebound to the previous pressures. Some animals rebound higher. With nitrite, we saw this vasodilation and a persistence up to 90 minutes. We still had a 30% vasodilation at 90 minutes. Exhaled NO, a persistence in exhaled NO, and met hemoglobin levels increase, but they're not really clinically significant. And this response appears to be quite controlled. So in summary, from these experiments, we found that inhaled nitrite generated NO gas and vasodilated the pulmonary circulation preferentially in a hypoxic model, although also in the normoxic model, which we're interested in potentiation with sildenafil, for example. So now I'd like to share with you unpublished data. This is a collaboration with Augustine Choi, and it was his idea to look at this, and Brian Zuckerbaum from his group, and Michael Mathier from their group, and Shruti Shiva from my group, really looking at the hypoxic model of pulmonary hypertension. And we don't have mechanism here, but I'll just share with you this unpublished data. It's a work in process right now. But in this model, as you know, RV pressures rise over 4 weeks. We then looked at a number of dosing schemes. The mice were put in a box and nebulized over the systemically exposed to nebulized nitrite. At 1/30th of the dose we used in that previous Nature Medicine paper. Interestingly, we gave it once per week, which was actually an accident, a miscommunication between our labs. I never would have thought once per week would do anything. We gave it three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and three times a week after 2 weeks. And interestingly, we measured the blood levels, whole blood, plasma, and lung. And when these mice are exposed, they're really not inhaling that much. I mean, the blood nitrite doubles. The plasma nitrite triples. And the exposure results in about a 60-minute exposure to a tripling of physiologic levels of nitrite. And if we look at the lung, under normoxia, the nitrite goes up. But if they're hypoxic, the nitrite's immediately consumed and turned over. And you've seen these experiments. This is the control. This is the hypoxic. And this is hypoxic with nitrite once a week, three times a week, and three times a week only in the last 2 weeks, a reduction in RV pressure, a reduction in RV mass. Michael Mathier looked at echocardiography, a reduction in change in pressure over time for all regimens, and a reduction in RV area. Again, this is preliminary, but looking at the monocrotalin rat model, 3 weeks of treatment and 3 weeks later, nitrite at three times per week. Again, for this is the monocrotalin effect alone. This is a nitrite control alone and nitrite with monocrotalin, a drop in RV mass, a drop in RV mass relative to body weight, and a drop in RV pressure. So in conclusion, increasing data from our group and multiple other groups suggest that nitrite may be the largest reservoir for nitric oxide in mammals at least, and that this, as oxygen and pH drops, there's a variety of enzymes, heme enzymes, such as hemoglobin, myoglobin, xanthine oxidoreductase, and potentially other heme-containing systems such as P450, that will reduce nitrite along the physiologic oxygen gradient to NO. In addition, nitrite appears to very facilely modify proteins. It can form N-nitrosamines, S-nitrosothiols, nitrated lipids, and iron nitrosyl complex. And from a mechanistic standpoint, it's very interesting to us that in work from Shruti Shiva in our lab, we found that nitrite can potently modify complex 1 in the mitochondria and modulate respiration. And that could be involved in the energetics of the proliferative response. Bruce Freeman's group has found that nitrated lipids are highly potent and specific PPAR gamma activating agents. And this intrigues me with Marlene's presentation yesterday, that perhaps PPAR signaling is involved. A number of investigators are now shown that nitrite modulates signal transduction. It's an intrinsic signaling molecule, and that it may have pleiotropic therapeutic effects. I just want to recognize this work. Again, is a lot of this has been collaborative for my group, Shruti Shiva, Christian Hunter, and innumerable people on our clinical team. My mentors, Richard Cannon and Alan Schechter, close collaborators, Danny Kim Shapiro, Rakesh Patel, and Neil Hogg. And I really want to thank the University of Pittsburgh team. And I want to recognize my personal Prozac that helps me weather the tough peer reviews, the home team.
Well, Mark, you've set a great example as the director of the course of actually staying on time within your 20 minutes. I think you're probably
I had to show up, Dr. Machado.
That. Mark's presentation is open for questions. Can you please remember to introduce yourself and your institution?
Tim McMahon, Duke University. Mark, the very nice data.
Thank you.
Very interesting. The nitrite reductase hypothesis still needs still is lacking one thing, and you've acknowledged this in some of your papers, and that is a mechanism for escape of the NO equivalents formed from the red blood cell. And the presence of methemoglobin may help very proximally, but the NO formed still needs to overcome millimolar hemoglobin within the red cell and escape. And Stamler's group and others have shown similar reactions of nitrite with hemoglobin being better described as a SNO synthase function, S-nitrosothiol synthase. This would allow the NO equivalence in the form of SNO to escape from the red cell. And I think this would better account for a lot of the biology that you're seeing.
Let me ask you a question. Would that latter process which I think is reasonable, would that require the cysteine 93?
Yes, it would.
Okay. So I think this is, I think you're bringing up the major controversy in the field. I think we all agree that red cells can modulate NO-dependent hypoxic vasodilation. And the question is, what's the mechanism? Is hemoglobin a nitrite reductase, or is hemoglobin a transport reservoir and allosteric delivery vehicle for a SNO moiety, and is cysteine 93 involved in that? And we do, you know, I just have to say we have some very, we have new data that will be coming out soon, really looking at the mechanism, how this nitrite reductase activity can export nitric oxide, but I just can't share that now. But I will say that this is imminently testable, that we should be able to knock out the cysteine, we should be able to test the nitrite effect, and I think we'll sort this out in the next year. But I think that, you know, I applaud you guys for really creating this field and introducing this paradigm, and I think that it's obviously a great controversy, but, you know, this is something that I think will work out with knockouts, with continued understanding of the chemistry.
And I think we should also keep in mind that the mechanism, we may know the mechanism from some simple in vitro studies, but extending these mechanisms to animal models and humans, we have to do that with great caution, especially when the concentrations of nitrite go up to the high micromolar range like we're seeing.
Sure. Mike?
Hi, Mark. I'm Mike Espy, and I'm also a poor NIH scientist. In lines with what Tim was talking about, we see, in addition to the red blood cell, many mechanisms in the tissue that are independent of the RBC or hemoglobin that can very efficiently reduce nitrite to NO. And so I'd just like to throw that out. We're looking at cancer. And in line with what Norbert was talking about yesterday, cancer and pulmonary hypertension have many similarities. So I'd like to raise the issue that pulmonary hypertensive tissue may have many mechanisms that are adaptive toward nitrite reduction that, in addition to hemoglobin, could reduce nitrite and have therapeutic efficacy. The other thing that I'd like to add is that you really don't need a lot of nitrite. And so comparing mouse to human and absolute levels, a little bit of nitrite goes a long way. And so we're talking about really nanomolar quantities that can activate guanyl cyclase or perhaps other pathways. And so just bear that in mind, that you really don't have to slam the system to get a good bang for your buck.
Okay. I'll turn that into a question. We absolutely agree. And I think that there's probably a paradigm where clearly nitrite's bioactive, and it's an intrinsic signaling molecule, and it's remarkably potent in all these disease models. Probably the greatest potency, which has been very surprising to us, is IR. We can give a rat 480 picomoles of nitrite the day before, and the next day subject them to IR injury and see cardioprotection and hepatoprotection. And these doses are far below what we got in our spinach salad the other night. So it's clearly a very potent signaling molecule, and one of the models that we've proposed is that essentially multiple nitrite reductases become employed and operate at differential oxygen tensions. For example, hemoglobin will operate at its P50. That's a PO2 of 27 millimeters of mercury. We've found myoglobin is a very potent nitrite reductase at PO2s below 2, and we have data that's going to come out soon showing that that can modulate mitochondrial respiration, but you have to have your PO2 down to 2 there. Xanthine oxidoreductase will reduce nitrite at very low PO2 and pH values, and it's likely that there's other pathways to bioactivation, as you've mentioned, from P450s to other molecules. So I think that's a ripe area for research.
Ruben Tudor from Hopkins, also a very elegant talk. But I know that, you know, without getting the controversial generation, how you get to the NO stage, but let's look at the downstream effects. So if you take that, you know, severe pulmonary hypertension has increased in phosphodiesterase expression of the blood vessels, the NO, at least in terms of downstream effects, it's as good or as bad as you wish to look at, depending which glasses you're wearing that day. So, and I think that is a critical aspect as it relates to applicability of nitrites or any other means to increase NO. So how can you define this, the downstream effects is going to be beneficial in a certain setting, a specific patient population, vis-a-vis being detrimental, pending which kind of remodeling, which kind of NO signaling downstream is activated?
And no, that's a great question. I don't have an answer for you. We know that we make NO in this chemistry, in vivo and in vitro. We see increases in cyclic G. We see inhibition with ODQ. We see activity in the NOS knockouts and the HO1 knockouts. So we really know what it's not. The nitrite effect is independent of NOS. It's independent of HO1. We don't yet know what it is in that I'm sure many of the effects, like the IR effects, the proliferative effects, and the vasodilator effects represent different mechanisms. So I think this is, you know, very early. 2 years ago, nitrite was inert. You know, PNAS paper stated, the title of a PNAS paper was nitrite has no intrinsic vasodilator activity. So now we're madly working on understanding in these various models what the signal transduction pathways are. And as I said, we've been quite surprised by some of the activities that are clearly probably not mediated by authentic NO.
Really interesting, Mark Berlin Rabinovich from Stanford. Just a comment along those lines. When we gave NO donors, we found that we blocked phosphorylation of ERK, so just some simple readouts might be very interesting with the nitrite compounds as well. And that might throw the cells into apoptosis if you did that.
Thank you.
Maybe I have the privilege for the last question to you, because more from a therapeutical standpoint, and you know that we decent people are the last to say that inhalation therapy is not a very good thing for targeting pulmonary hypertension. But as you said, in the field research with spinach salad and hot dogs, nitrite has proved to be orally bioavailable. So what would be the rationale for a treatment purpose to use it via inhalation versus the oral administration? Is it a matter of selectivity or higher local doses that you're going to look for?
Yeah, that's a great question, and at the risk of rambling, two comments. One is, if you look at our newborn sheep model to see a actual vasodilation that is in line with the potency of nitric oxide, we gave industrial strength nitrite. This would require, we need to do more tox work, which are planned, to look at how safe that will be, but we have nebulized it for 24 hours in sheep. We see no problems. Again, it's a naturally occurring molecule. There's actually quite high concentrations in alveoli already. So for the vasodilatory effects in that system, we gave high doses. For the preventative and reversal of the proliferative response, these doses were at the near physiologic level once a week, and you saw an area under the curve for actual measurable blood and tissue levels with the most sensitive methodology of 60 minutes or less. That's what we see with IR. We see dosing, the lowest dose that we see prevent MI will only increase the blood level 200 nanomolar in a mouse with a basal level of 1,000 nanomolar. So really about a 10 to 20% increase in blood level reduces infarct size by about 50%. So I think that the dose effect will be different depending on the model. Now about the diet, this is a fascinating area. A lot of people in the field are wildly speculating about whether this is the active ingredient in the Mediterranean diet. If you look at the Mediterranean diet and the Western diet has no nitrate nitrite. You know, we regulate it out of our water, avian water, you know, advertised zero nitrate. We don't eat fruits and vegetables in America. We eat uncured meats and we eat potatoes and starch. No nitrate or nitrite. The Mediterranean diet is loaded with nitrate and nitrite. Cured meats have nitrite, you know, salamis, prosciuttos. Leafy greens, vegetables, salad are loaded with nitrate. And John Lundberg and the Karolinska has shown that nitrate is concentrated in our saliva. We actually swallow 1.5 liters of saliva a day. Bacteria in our tongue are symbiotic bacteria that reduce nitrate to nitrite, and then we get systemic absorption of nitrite as well as conversion of nitrite in the stomach to NO, which has a host defense factor. So they're currently looking at epidemiology in Sweden at whether nitrate is cardioprotective in diet, and is that the magical ingredient of leafy green vegetables. Because of the potency of the nitrite we've just seen now in this pulmonary hypertension model, I think Augustine's group and I should consider giving it systemically or doing it in the diet. We have done studies now with dietary nitrite on MI and liver IR, as well as in the sickle cell mouse, and we do see that the diet, if you put it in the water, it does modulate responses to those hits. But I think that's a great question. Thank you.
Excuse me. That was great, Mark. And so now it's my pleasure to introduce Manfred Boyne from the NIH, NHLBI, and he is going to speak on future therapies of PH, anti-proliferative strategies targeting cell cycle regulation.
Before I start, I have to apologize that my voice is in really bad shape. But before I lose my voice, I would like to thank the organizer for an excellent meeting and also for giving me the opportunity to introduce our new project initiative, anti-proliferative strategy targeting cell cycle regulators in pulmonary hypertension. The Intramural program and my lab too has a long-standing interest in molecular regulation of vascular proliferative disease or vascular wound repair after mechanical injury. Very recently, Mark and Roberto showed us histological slides from a patient with pulmonary hypertension. And I was really surprised how similar the lesion, the vascular lesion in pulmonary hypertension is to the vascular proliferative disease we frequently see in our animal models. You are probably very familiar with this kind of histology. You see a concentric lesion from a patient with pulmonary hypertension who has inflammation in the adventitia. It's characterized by a smooth muscle cell proliferation, extracellular matrix deposition, and endothelial cell proliferation and thrombosis. This is very similar to vascular proliferative disease found in our animal models, where you also see a massive infiltration of inflammatory cells, smooth muscle cell proliferation, endothelial cell proliferation, and deposition of matrix proteins. The similarity between these two histology suggested to us that successful treatment for this kind of disease in patients with angioplasty and stent placement might be also very useful to treat patients with pulmonary hypertension. Today, I would like to talk to you about our understanding of the cellular and molecular regulation of vascular remodeling after mechanical injury and how this can be translated into a therapeutic approach in pulmonary hypertension. Cell proliferation is the model for that, is the cell cycle. I would like to start with an introduction into cell cycle, introducing P27 as a key regulator. Then I talk about P27 and its role in vascular remodeling in a mechanical injury model. Then I would like to discuss with you about the work of other people in the role of P27 and pulmonary hypertension. And then at the end, I would like to discuss with you our anti-proliferative strategies for the treatment of pulmonary hypertension. The cell cycle consists of four separate phases. The S phase, where the DNA is synthesized, the M phase, where the nuclei are duplicated, and the cell finally divides. These two phases are divided by so-called gap or G phases. The G phase are necessary for the proper progression through S phase and through M phase. Specifically, the G1 to S gap phase or G1S checkpoint is growth factor dependent and plays a very important role in the regulation of cell proliferation in vascular proliferative diseases. The transition of this checkpoint is regulated by the cyclin and cyclin-dependent kinases. These cyclin-dependent kinases phosphorylates RB, which in its hyperphosphorylated stage releases transcription factor, which are pivotal for the transcription of S phase important genes. The activity of these kinases are very tightly controlled by cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors, P21, P27, and P57, among others. P27 is essential in growth factor mediated cell growth regulation. Mitochondrial stimuli upregulate cyclin D. Cyclin D titrates P27 away from the cyclin E cyclin dependent kinase complex. Free cyclin E complex phosphorylates RB, which in a positive feedback mechanism through E2A produces more cyclin E. This cyclin E then finally phosphorylates P27, which leads to the rapid destruction of P27, the inhibitor of cyclin E. The circuit ensures a rapid activation of the cyclins and a rapid destruction of the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor. P27 is known to be a very important protein in the regulation of vascular proliferative disease. In the work of Felix Tanner, he describes the expression pattern of P27 on protein level in uninjured and in injured arteries of the pig at different stages of wound repair. In an uninjured pig artery, P27 is localized throughout the media seen in the red staining. After injury and growth factor and cytokine release, P27 is rapidly downregulated. At the same time, the wound repair program proceeds and the neointima is formed, indicated by the arrows. At later stage of the wound repair, when the wound repair is actually finished at day 14, P27 expression is reestablished and the growth of the neointima is finished. To further characterize the function of P27 in vascular proliferative disease, we use the P27 knockout mice and explore if deletion of P27 in vascular smooth muscle cell would alter the growth ability of these cells. As you can see here, P27 knockout smooth muscle cell grow at a much higher rate compared to heterozygous and wild type. Also, BRDO incorporation is massively increased in the P27 knockout compared to the wild type, indicated for a higher mitotic activity. Oops. Last not least, cell cycle progression is accelerated in the P27 knockout compared to the wild type cell, indicated by a decreased number in G1 phase cells and increased number in S and G2 phase. Next, we were very interested in what is the role of P27 in vivo. So we performed a mechanical wire injury in the femoral artery of the mice and explore the wound repair at different phases. As you can see, 1 week after injury, the overall proliferation in the vessel is highly increased in the P27 knockout compared to the wild-type mice. Also, the neointima formation is dramatically accelerated. Even at 1 week, you already see significant increase in neointima formation measured by the intima to media ratio between P27 and knockouts to wild-type knockout. The corresponding histology is shown over here. You see a massive infiltration of cells in the neointima area compared here to the wild type. This is even more pronounced at 2 weeks, where the lumen of the vessel is almost completely closed compared to the wild type. Most cells of the neointima, also some cells in the media, are alpha actin positive, indicating that these are smooth muscle cells. What really struck us at when we looked at this histological section is this enormous infiltration of mononuclear cells. This indicates that inflammation is an important part in the process of vascular remodeling and that P27 is an important regulator in this. In our model, arterial macrophages are increased at 1 week and 2 weeks in the P27 compared to the wild-type knockout mice, as well are T cells and neutrophils. This is also shown here in the histological section from wild type and P27 adult mice. And you see that most of these mononuclear cells at the later stage are localized in the adventitia or in the, perivascular region. To further characterize this inflammatory response, we measured a whole array of cytokines, and I show you only 9 of 30 we actually measured. But it's very clear that vascular injury, mechanical vascular injury, induces fast and big reaction of cytokine release at 3 days and 7 days. And there is a big difference between wild type and knockout animals in regard to certain cytokines, like cytokines that regulate macrophages, MCP1, MIP1, and T cells like RANDAS. Also, increased numbers of growth factor like TGF-beta or GM-CSF are released. Although T cells are less abundant than macrophages and neutrophils, they appear to play a central role in the regulation of vascular remodeling or vascular proliferative disease. Drug minus-minus knockout mice are T and B cell depleted. If we perform our vascular injury, we see a reduction in neointima formation at 2 weeks. We then perform bone marrow transplantations between wild type and P27 using RAC null and wild type marrow. And you see that as well in the P27 knockout mice and in the wild type mice, transplantation with RAC minus minus marrow dramatically decrease the formation of the neointima. The same is true for the wild type. We then further characterized that by performing a bone marrow transplantation into wild-type mice using P27 marrow and then block the maturation of the T cells by thymectomy. And as you can see, the neointima formation is dramatically decreased, indicating that P27 function in T cells might play an important role in this process. I showed you data indicating that P27 is important in local cells, like smooth muscle cells, probably endothelial cells. And I also showed you data that P27 is important in activation of the immune response. But what is the relative contribution of both compartments to the vascular remodeling process? To answer these questions, we did a couple of bone marrow transplantation experiments where we transplanted wild-type animals with wild-type and with P27 knockout marrow. And as you expected from the inflammatory results, we see an increase in the neointima formation. If we transplant P27 knockout mice with wild-type, we see a decrease in the neointima formation. But what is interesting that both of these two transplantations do not reach their actual control, indicating that both compartments, inflammatory compartment as well as local vascular compartment and function of P27 in this compartment is essential in the vascular remodeling process. Similar can be seen here in macrophage function, where we perform the same bone marrow transplantation, and P27 function in local cells is as well important to control macrophage function as P27 in circulating immune cells. These are representative immunohistochemistry where you see the corresponding formation of the neointima. To summarize, bone marrow-derived immune progenitor cells modulate arterial wound repair. P27 regulates the contribution of bone marrow-derived cell and local vascular cell to the vascular lesion. And lymphocytes play the dominant role in the initial phase of the arterial wound repair. So I told you about what we think is the role of P27 in vascular remodeling in a mechanical injury. But what is known about P27 function in pulmonary hypertension? is the regulation of the vascular remodeling in pulmonary hypertension similar to what we see in the vascular remodeling after mechanical injury? Going through the literature, I have to say there's much less known about P27 in pulmonary hypertension. I think there needs much more work done by us and by other groups to establish P27 as an important regulator in the vascular remodeling in pulmonary hypertension. However, what I found looks very similar to what we see in mechanical injury. The group of Rubin Tudor described that P27 regulates endothelial cell proliferation in plexiform lesions. Actually, he uses P27 as a gross marker in endothelial cells in human lesion, indicating that if endothelial cells have P27, they are gross arrested, they are not proliferating. However, if he doesn't see P27, it's an indication that these endothelial cells are actively proliferating. In addition, David Trotman showed that P27 is an important regulator in pulmonary arterial smooth muscle cell proliferation. More functional data were provided in a publication by Yu in Circulation by Charles Hiles. So he explored the use of heparin in hypoxia-induced pulmonary hypertension. And he found that heparin easily reversed the effect of pulmonary hypertension on right ventricular pressure as well as on Fulton ratio. It does that as well in P27 heterozygous mice, but it does not affect pulmonary hypertension in P27 knockout mice, indicating that P27 is essential for the heparin-induced prevention or reduction of pulmonary hypertension. In the same experiment, in the same paper, they described that P21, which is very closely related to P27, is not affected or does not affect heparin treatment. The same group then describes in a later publication the expression pattern of different cell cycle regulator and found that none of these cell cycle regulator are actually affected by hypoxia-induced pulmonary hypertension, nor by treatment with heparin, except P27. P27 is markedly and rapidly downregulated on protein level upon hypoxia, and heparin that prevent the pulmonary hypertension, reverse P27 back to the normal level, mirroring a similar situation in mechanical injury where P27 downregulation is important for the onset of the development of vascular remodeling. As we heard yesterday and also today, the BMP receptor and mutations as well as level of BMP receptor is very important in the pathology of pulmonary hypertension. In a recent publication by Sarov, they found that actually BMP receptor or BMP is signaling through the BMP receptor, activating SMAD, leading to upregulation of P27 and cell differentiation. On the other hand, if he blocks BMP signaling by knock-in, you get a downregulation and a downregulation of P27. In a patient with pulmonary hypertension, you have exactly this kind of situation. We think it's reasonable that anti-proliferative therapy might be successful in treatment pulmonary hypertension by targeting regulators similar to P27. Anti-proliferative therapy for coronary vascular proliferation after balloon angioplasty is very successful. There are two drugs used at the moment. One is sirolimus and the other one is paclitaxel, which basically revolutionized our treatment of coronary vascular proliferation. These are two older clinical studies which showed dramatic reduction of neo-intima formation, restenosis or vasoproliferative, how you want to name it. Once for serous taxus using sirolimus and using paclitaxel. Sirolimus blocks mitogen-induced downregulation of P27. Actually, the first P27 function was linked to the effect of rapamycin and T-cell activation, I think almost 10 years ago. Sironimus is antiproliferative, anti-migratory, and has anti-inflammatory effect, and it uses cell cycle effect, arrest. It does not depend on P27, so if you knock out P27, rapamycin or sironimus still induces cell cycle effect. Paclitaxel inhibits microtubule formation. So microtubule formation plays a role when the chromosomes are segregated in MG2 phase. Very different from what rapamycin and P27 is doing. It's much later in the cell cycle. Paclitaxel is antiproliferative, antimicrotic, migratory, and anti-inflammatory effects. Paclitaxel induced cell cycle arrest and apoptosis because it arrests the cell in the phase of the cell cycle where usually a cell cannot be arrested, different to rapamycin or sironimus, who arrest the cells in G1. A paclitaxel is known to induce apoptosis. So we think that sironimus and paclitaxel alone or in combination might be a promising antiproliferative therapy for pulmonary hypertension because it's targeting important pathway in cell cycle proliferation, in cell proliferation, combination of both targets, different phases of the cell cycle, induce cell cycle arrest and apoptosis of proliferating cells, and successful treatment of local vascular proliferative disease was shown in humans. However, the caveat is that it was shown for local application and not tested for a systemic application, organic-wide application, like you would need if you want to try to treat pulmonary hypertension. However, in animal models, 5 or 6 years ago, showed that systemic applications as potent inhibition neoedema formation and local application. The more important point is that these drugs are given to prevent a vascular proliferative disease. We know exactly when the onset of the disease is, which is very different from pulmonary hypertension, where we have to test these drugs if the progression and the regression of the disease is possible. The conclusion is pulmonary hypertension has features of a vascular proliferative disease. Antiproliferative therapy might improve the outcome of patients with pulmonary hypertension. Antiproliferative therapy with sironimus and paclitaxel might be beneficial for patients with pulmonary hypertension. Future directions. We are planning to explore interaction between inflammatory cells and locus vascular cells during the development of pulmonary hypertension in wild-type and P27 knockout mice. We are testing antiproliferative therapy with sironimus and paclitaxel. And we are planning collaboration with Mark Ledwing and Innova Fairfax Hospital, a phase 1 trial with sironimus and paclitaxel in patient failing maximal currently available therapy. In the last slide, I'd like to thank the members of my lab, the collaborators from Betsy Nabel's lab on the vascular proliferative injury model, and our collaborations with Mark Ledwing and Stephen Nathan from Fairfax. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this really thought-provoking, still a very well-balanced presentation. Paper is open for discussion. Norbert?
Thank you also for the talk. I think it is fascinating that we are here talking about anti-proliferative strategies in pulmonary hypertension. The point that you made at the end of your talk, I think, is perhaps the most worrisome, which is that at the time we get to the patients, they have established disease. And I think it will require the clinical trials to figure out whether indeed at that point when the pulmonary artery pressure is a mean of 50 and the cardiac output is 3 liters, we can actually change the outcome and induce perhaps apoptosis with drugs like that, or whether that is not enough. So I'm looking forward to the clinical trials very much in this context.
Yeah, thank you.
My comments along the same lines. You know, there was that paper, I think it was from Peter Cow, showing that you could prevent pulmonary hypertension with rapamycin in an animal model. I think I've got the right author. Mm-hmm. But so we followed up on that, and it's not published yet, but it's under revision. And just in reference to what Norbert said, we gave rapamycin in a variety of different doses, a variety of durations, and we could not get any regression of pulmonary hypertension. And we showed that the S6 kinase was inhibited, so it was an effective dose of rapamycin. And I think there is this issue about whether you want to block, and I don't know the answer, but I guess I throw that open to you. Is the best strategy to block proliferation, is that still going on late in the disease? I suspect it's not very much. Or is it better to cause apoptosis and get rid of the bad players that are still there? That's sort of a question.
And you're saying that rapamycin does not regress the disease, correct?
I'm saying that we couldn't get rapamycin to regress monocrotaline-induced pulmonary hypertension, although it can prevent it.
It can prevent but not regress, right?
Yeah, I think there's a publication by Peter Cow.
Yeah, I know, yeah. So I just couldn't hear it very well. Yes, I also agree. So. I think it works. It goes very well with what we know about rapamycin, that it does not, it blocks, it stops the proliferation, but it does not regress or induce apoptosis. Therefore, we are planning actually to do combination with an almost cytostatica like Taxol in combination with rapamycin to induce apoptosis in cells that are proliferating, and rapamycin on top of that to prevent reactive inflammation, reactive growth of cells that are.
It was good at making rats sick.
Pardon me?
The rats didn't like it. Just as a cautionary note, it made them quite sick.
Rapamycin.
Yes. Just like it does in patients, but.
Aaron?
Yes, Aaron Dick in Boston, Massachusetts. Coming at this from a lung transplantation perspective, just one issue I would like to raise as people are considering antiproliferative agents for use in this disease is what happens when patients progress while on these agents and come to transplantation. There clearly is a higher incidence of very significant surgical complications, specifically airway dehiscence in patients who are using rapamycin early for immunosuppression. And so when patients who have PAH are treated with these, or might be treated with these agents, come to transplantation, there is a concern about how they might fare during that operation, depending on the kinetics of the antiproliferative agent. I don't think that there's an easy answer for that, but it's something that we should be considering when thinking about these agents. Mm.
Yeah, we are aware of the risk with rapamycin and Taxol, and we choose it as a last opportunity for in patients who have maximal therapy already.
It's not what happens to them as they're treated late in their disease, but what happens to them when they come to transplant. They can be at significant risk for major complications during the transplant if they've been treated with these agents before. And we've had experience with this in patients who've had retransplants on rapamycin and they don't heal their airway at all.
Ruben?
Yeah. I'd like to come back to the beginning of your talk, how you developed the paradigm of P27, and I think this is, again, it has, you know, going back to comparing the animal models and comparing the human disease. So the animal models, we have a starting date. We can choose the day that we are going to start the experiment. And we destabilize the system as much as we can with drugs and so on. And, of course, we are looking at something that recapitulates in some degree the human disease. So it is what I'm suggesting is that when you create pulmonary hypertension with whatever model you're doing, you really have a very dynamic system. And I think that your angioplasty, and even in humans as well, because there is an acute event, you time it when you want, you impart a major disruption of homeostasis, you have a very dynamic system of growth. And therefore, any time that you have a very dynamic system, cells that are growing, they are actually susceptible to growth inhibition or to expression of cell cycle arrest or promoting cell cycle arrest. So you have the outcomes that you showed nicely. And I think that probably this justifies why almost everything that we do to monocrotaline, apparently works. And when we go to the human disease, and I think this is a challenge, that it is not a dynamic system anymore. When we have, and I actually tried to literalize that a couple of years ago in a Red Journal paper editorial, that when we look at the P27 proliferation markers or whatever in the human disease, the cells are not proliferating anymore. So you have a stable situation where it clearly is a disease, but the cells are almost kind of an arresting stage. And I think that the challenge is to understand what is making these cells survive. What I'm really afraid is that when we see the vascular damage that is probably going in multiple rounds, what has happened is almost like a scar. The scar is very hard to get away. With whatever way you try to do, you cannot get a keloid out except by surgery. And I think that this is the very much of the challenge when the P27 may be absolutely relevant in a very dynamic lesion like what you showed, even in monocrotaline or hypoxia or any other model that's very, you know, active. But when you go to the human, the challenge is really having to understand what's keeping these cells alive, because the signal that proliferated them in the beginning is absolutely gone.
Well, Bob Francis from Mayo Clinic. Just a word of caution about sirolimus. We frequently use it in our heart transplant recipients, and occasionally, especially in patients with some pre-existing lung disease, you can have a really life-threatening pulmonary toxicity with hemorrhage, and so if patients are given this with pH and their dyspnea worsens, be looking for interstitial injury, which can sometimes be a life-threatening complication of oral sirolimus therapy.
Thanks, everyone. We are going to adjust. Oh, one last question.
Sure. Stephen Tofrich, Pittsburgh. I have a question and comment regarding the use of the tubulin inhibitors. We used in monocrotaline model in male and female rats 2-methoxyestradiol, and it works, and it's basically potent a tubulin inhibitor, similar to Taxol. And that's basically a drug that was already in clinical trials for the cancer. And we also show in cell culture that also upregulates the P27 and prevents and retards the progression of monocrotaline and hypoxia-induced pulmonary hypertension.
Okay, we are going to adjust the break upwards a little bit since we're running behind from this morning, and we have one speaker who is not going to be here this afternoon. So we'll take our coffee break now. It's 10 o'clock, and we would like everyone back at 10:20 to start the second part of the session. Thanks.
All right, well, thank you. All of the audience recognize the huge clinical impact statins have had in the treatment of patients with coronary artery disease and other types of systemic atherosclerosis. And they are potent inhibitors of cholesterol, but it's becoming increasingly recognized over the last decade that patients with coronary artery disease have clinical benefits with statin therapy that appear to be independent of their ability to lower cholesterol. And this is felt. Many of these effects are felt to be related to the fact that while statins block hydroxymethylglycerol coenzyme A reductase, which is the rate-limiting step in cholesterol biosynthesis, reducing the synthesis of mevalonate. Mevalonate, while it's the precursor of cholesterol, it's also the precursor of several isoprenoid lipid intermediate compounds, notably farnesyl and geraniol. And these lipid intermediates are required for the post-translational modification of Rho and other small G proteins that is required for them to attach to membranes where they can mediate their GTPA signaling activity, thereby mediating a host of downstream effects, among them the activation of Rho kinase. So a variety of agonists or stimuli at the cell surface mediate this Rho A GTPase activity, then that mediates, among other things, the activation of Rho kinase. And Rho kinase, well-characterized effect of it is that it phosphorylates the myosin basic subunit of myosin phosphatase, which ultimately leads to a reduction in phosphorylated myosin light chain and therefore more relaxation of vascular smooth muscle. But for this Rho and other small G proteins to be at the membrane to mediate these effects, it requires the attachment of these lipid intermediates, among, and for Ro, specifically geranylgeranyl, which is a byproduct of mevalonate. So these so-called pleiotropic actions of statins, really a host of them, quite remarkable. They've been really looked at in every almost every disease that you can imagine. But in terms of the particular pleiotropic actions that would be important for pulmonary arterial hypertension, I've listed a few of them here. In vascular smooth muscle, I already mentioned that by reducing phosphorylated myosin light chain, it can reduce vascular tone that's independent of cytosolic calcium concentrations. There are also potent inhibitors of vascular smooth muscle cell proliferation and migration, and they have been shown, and this is felt to be related to their ability to increase P27KIP1, which we just heard about. They can also, they're potent inducers of smooth muscle cell apoptosis as a result of reduction in BCL2 that leads to consequent caspase activation. One of the earliest pleiotropic effects that were identified was in vascular endothelium, where they were shown to be able to stabilize the message for ENOS. But independent of increasing ENOS protein, they're able to enhance ENOS activity through, among other actions, increase in the phosphorylation of ENOS at the serine 1177 site that enhances its activity. And we've heard yesterday about endothelial progenitor cells. The statins have been shown to increase those. They've also been shown to improve endothelial cell survival and proliferation and angiogenesis, perhaps related to their ability to increase PI3 kinase and phosphorylate AKT. They are also potent antioxidants, at least in part due to their ability to inhibit RAC. Another, it's in the same family as RhoA, and RAC is important for the activity of NADPH oxidase. They also have antiplatelet effects and really a variety of anti-inflammatory effects that, again, may be relevant in pulmonary arterial hypertension. And actually, statins have been studied in a variety of different models of pulmonary hypertension. They've been studied in chronic hypoxia, in the monocrotaline model. They've also been looked at in the two models that we've heard about at this meeting that induce a more severe pulmonary hypertension with neointimal proliferation. They've been, and that's the monocrotaline plus pneumonectomy model, and in the chronic hypoxia plus VEGF receptor blockade model. So I'll go through some of the data shown with statins in these different models. We've done some work in the chronic hypoxia model, and showing here the right ventricular mass over left ventricular plus septum as an indicator of right ventricular hypertrophy. As expected, after 2 weeks of hypoxia, rats get significant right ventricular hypertrophy. And with simvastatin treatment in this experiment, given at a dose of 20 mg per kilo per day orally, there is simvastatin therapy significantly attenuated the development of right ventricular hypertrophy. There are parallel changes in pulmonary artery pressure as well that mimic this. Now, when the rats are supplemented in addition to simvastatin, they're given mevalonate in their drinking water. This protective effect of simvastatin is lost. And mevalonate alone has no effect in the setting of hypoxia. So this shows that the protective effects of simvastatin are, in fact, related to their ability to inhibit HMG-CoA reductase. And shown here are representative photomicrographs compared to normoxia. 2 weeks of hypoxia induces this prominent thickening of the intraalveolar small pulmonary arteries. Simvastatin therapy prevents this to a large extent, but mevalonate leads to loss of the protective effects of simvastatin. We wanted to explore some potential cellular mechanisms that are involved. We looked at ability of simvastatin to inhibit smooth muscle cell proliferation. We looked at the proliferation early in the hypoxic exposure at 4 days with proliferating cell nuclear antigen staining. And in the hypoxia control animals, there is over half of the small intraalveolar arteries have positive PCNA staining that is fairly intense, whereas simvastatin reduced the percentage of cell of vessels that were PCNA positive, and the ones that were PCNA positive had reduced intensity, so suggesting that part of the effects, at least in the attenuation experiment, was a reduction in smooth muscle cell proliferation. We then went on to look whether simvastatin is able to induce regression of established chronic hypoxic pulmonary hypertension. In this experiment, animals were left hypoxic for 2 weeks, and then remained in the hypoxia chamber for an additional 2 weeks, but simvastatin was added. And comparing the pulmonary artery pressure with four-week hypoxic controls, mean pulmonary artery pressure fell from 27 to 19, and this was comparable to the pulmonary artery pressure seen in the two-week attenuation experiment. And along with the reduction in pulmonary artery pressure, there was regression in right ventricular hypertrophy and in the medial wall thickness of these small intraalveolar arteries. To explore potential cellular mechanisms for the regression of hypoxic pulmonary hypertension, we looked at the ability of statins to induce apoptosis in smooth muscle cells. And here we're doing a immunofluorescence stain co-localizing caspase and smooth muscle actin. And we see that in the hypoxic control animals, that 17 days of hypoxia, there is little or no caspase staining in the vascular smooth muscle cells that are stained blue, and the DAPI is staining blue here for the nuclei. Whereas with 3 days of simvastatin therapy, after 14 days of hypoxia, there some of these vessels had considerable amount of caspase positive smooth muscle cells. So this is suggesting that part of the mechanism of regression of hypoxic pulmonary hypertension by statin is the induction of apoptosis in smooth muscle cells. To explore certain selected molecular mechanisms that are involved in this process, given the known effects of statins on the Rho kinase pathway, look at the expression of Rho kinase enzyme in whole lung homogenates. And shown here is that under normoxic, this is normoxia plus simvastatin, 2 week hypoxia controls, there is a little bit of increase in Rho kinase expression that is dramatically reduced with simvastatin in the attenuation experiment. And then in the regression experiment where simvastatin was started after 2 weeks of hypoxia, in all three of these conditions, regression, attenuation, and under normoxic conditions, there is marked suppression of Rho kinase expression in the whole lung homogenates. And this effect was reversed when mevalonate was supplemented to the simvastatin-treated animals. And again, mevalonate alone had no effects. And we observed a similar pattern when we probed for Rho kinase isoenzyme 2 by the same technique, Western blotting of whole lung homogenates. We then moved on to look at the enzymatic activity of Rho kinase, and here we used a commercially available ELISA-type kit that probes for the phosphorylation of the myosin, basic subunit of myosin phosphatase, which is a target of Rho kinase. And we see here, after 2 weeks of hypoxia, there's marked increase in the Rho kinase activity that is normalized with simvastatin treatment. Similarly, in the regression experiment, after 2 weeks of simvastatin therapy, there's a marked reduction in the Rho kinase activity. Now, in contrast to the expression of the protein, mevalonate therapy only partially restored Rho kinase activity. And I'm not sure we don't have really a good explanation for that, but it would suggest that there may be some additional effects that are mevalonate independent that simvastatin has that may be involved in suppression of Rho kinase activity. Under normoxic conditions here, we didn't see a reduction in Rho kinase activity with simvastatin, but I think this is probably related to the fact that in this particular assay, the optical density in the normoxic samples was quite low to begin with, fairly just above the blank samples, and that was perhaps why we didn't see additional reduction with simvastatin. Now, statins have been looked at in a variety of other models besides chronic hypoxia. This is a recent study looking at monocrotaline given alone. Monocrotaline induces increase in right ventricular systolic pressure. And in this experiment, pravastatin was used at a dose of 10 milligram per kilogram per day, and there is attenuation in the right ventricular systolic pressure. And at least in this experiment, part of this, when they gave pravastatin along with Alnylam, a NOS inhibitor, some of this protective effect was lost, suggesting that part of the effect, beneficial effect, is related to increase in NOS activity. And in fact, they showed that in monocrotaline, it's well known that ENOS levels in the lung are reduced, ENOS expression is reduced, and pravastatin restored this at least partially. They also, from a functional standpoint, in this experiment showed that in isolated pulmonary arteries, pravastatin treatment improved acetylcholine-induced relaxation, suggesting improvement in activity of NOS function. In terms of the effects on apoptosis in the monocrotaline models, it's known that early on there is a lot of endothelial cell apoptosis induced by monocrotaline. And here the statin treatment reduced the endothelial cell apoptosis. It also reduced activity of the caspase in whole lung homogenous that was induced by monocrotaline. Another model of pulmonary hypertension, a little bit different. This is long-term smoking in rats, smoke exposure for 16 weeks that induces not only emphysema but also induces pulmonary vascular remodeling and some degree of pulmonary hypertension. And this model, simvastatin was given and inhibited the parenchymal destruction and emphysema that was observed by cigarette smoking. It also reduced the pulmonary vascular remodeling. This is normal controls. This is smoking. So there's just some vascular medial thickening. There's also perivascular inflammation. And both of those are reduced in simvastatin-treated smoking animals. This is simvastatin alone. So reduced the pulmonary hypertension, vascular remodeling, inflammation. They also looked at matrix metalloprotein 9 activation. That was reduced. And then this is showing immunostain for ENOS, showing this here in the endothelium. There's intense staining. This is lost with cigarette smoking and then is restored with simvastatin treatment. And this is quantification of that immunostaining grade for ENOS in control animals, smoking with simvastatin, and simvastatin alone. Another group, Murata in Japan, has looked at fluvastatin in the chronic hypoxia model and done some detailed work with NOS expression or NOS activity. And they showed that in the chronic hypoxia model, where normally ENOS is increased, there was no effect on ENOS expression per se, but there was restoration in the serine 1177 phospho-ENOS levels, which were suppressed with hypoxia, and this would lead to improved NOS activity. There was also a reduction with simvastatin treatment in the interaction with ENOS and with calveolin 1, and that interaction inhibits NOS activity. There was increased in the interaction of ENOS with HeSCHOT protein 90, which increases the activity of NOS. And then functional correlate was that fluvastatin treatment reverse the suppression of lung cyclic GMP content, again suggesting that it actually enhanced NOS activity in the absence of changes in ENOS protein itself. I will move on to some studies of statins in the more severe models of pulmonary hypertension. Peter Kao and his group at Stanford used the monocrotaline and pneumonectomy model. So in this setup, the animals get a pneumonectomy, and then 4 weeks later are given monocrotaline injection. Without monocrotaline injection, this is the pulmonary artery pressure. After 11 weeks of monocrotaline injection, there is a significant increase in the pulmonary artery pressure. In animals that were treated with a vehicle for 2 weeks after the full development of pulmonary hypertension, there was a further rise in pulmonary artery pressure. Whereas those animals treated with simvastatin therapy for 2 weeks, there was a significant reduction in pulmonary artery pressure. And another group of animals that were treated with simvastatin for 6 weeks, there was a further fall in pulmonary artery pressure approaching normal control values. So pretty remarkable regression of established disease here in this model. And histologically, relative to normal animals, there is this neointima obliterating the lumen of these peribronchial arteries. 2 weeks of simvastatin therapy began to regress this neointimal formation, and with 6 weeks of therapy, there's almost complete reversal of the changes. Peter Kao's group also looked at PCNA staining as well as tunnel staining in this neointimal lesion and showed that simvastatin reduced proliferative cells and appeared to be increasing apoptosis by tunnel assay. Dr. Vogel's group in Colorado has looked at simvastatin in their model of chronic hypoxia combined with VEGF receptor blockade using the SU5416 compound. In this model, there is also considerable intimal obliteration, but in contrast with the monocrotaline pneumonectomy model, The cells filling the lumen here are factor 8 positive endothelial cells that are proliferating. So in this model, their setup is that the rats are in a hypoxia chamber for 3 weeks. And they get the VEGF receptor antagonist at the beginning of that exposure. And then they're brought out of the hypoxia chamber and left at Denver altitude for an additional 3 weeks. And with that, they get, after 3 weeks, the pulmonary artery pressure is 47. And after an additional 3 weeks at Denver altitude, it progresses further to a pulmonary artery pressure of 68. In this experiment, they began the simvastatin treatment after 3 weeks in the hypoxia chamber and see what would happen when they were left an additional 3 weeks in Denver altitude. So at 6 weeks, then, the simvastatin-treated animals had a pulmonary artery pressure of 49 compared to 68 in the control animals. There was also it also prevented the progression of right ventricular hypertrophy with a ratio of 0.56 in the simvastatin-treated animals compared to 0.73. Histologically, compared with normal control animals, the small intraalveolar arteries had obliteration by these proliferating endothelial cells, and simvastatin treatment induced regression here. And also, on this caspase stain, there is endothelial cells that are staining for caspase 3, activated caspase 3, suggesting that there is the induction of endothelial cell apoptosis by simvastatin in this setup. And these investigators felt that, was an important mechanism leading to regression of these neoentamal lesions. So I think that this animal data is quite impressive and suggests that this may have a role, given with these, obviously these agents have a long track history, are safe, and the next question is, are they effective in patients with pulmonary artery hypertension? Peter Kao reported a small series of patients appeared to be well tolerated and perhaps effective in some selected cases. But obviously a randomized trial is required. But I'd like to just show you some data on another commonly used drug in systemic vascular disease, and that's low-dose aspirin. Ivan Robbins and Steve Kawit published this study. It was a crossover trial of aspirin and clopidogrel in patients with idiopathic pulmonary arterial hypertension. Both agents inhibited the platelet activity, but only aspirin reduced urinary metabolites of thromboxane. And we know that there is an imbalance between prostacyclin and thromboxane metabolites in pulmonary arterial hypertension. And so it's appeared to perhaps have make sense to try to reduce thromboxane levels, and aspirin appears to potently do this. So I think given this data along with the animal data with statins, Steve Kao at Columbia has submitted an R1 grant for a clinical trial to the NIH that was funded. It's called the ASA STAT study, and we expect to begin recruiting patients soon. It's a two-center trial in Columbia and Johns Hopkins. It's going to be a randomized, placebo-controlled, 2x2 factorial trial of aspirin and simvastatin in patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension. So four groups, placebo, aspirin and placebo, simvastatin and placebo, and the two together. Looking to recruit 128 patients. It'll be a six-month trial. It'll be add-on to pre-existing therapy, either prostanoids, endothelin antagonists, or PDE5 inhibitors. And the primary outcome is going to be a change in six-minute walk distance from baseline to 6 months. We're also going to look at selected secondary outcomes that would reflect improved endothelial cell function with simvastatin or suppression of platelet activity with aspirin. So we'll be looking at brachial artery flow-mediated vasodilatation and as a marker of improved endothelial cell function in the systemic circulation. Also be looking at von Willebrand factor as a marker of endothelial cell injury, and Steve has previously shown that circulating von Willebrand factor correlates with survival and pulmonary arterial hypertension. And we'll be looking at a variety of platelet markers to look at the effects of aspirin. Also going to look at quality of life and time to clinical worsening. This is data that Evelyn Horn in Steve's group has shown that we think of pulmonary arterial hypertension as something that's localized to the pulmonary circulation, but in fact she has shown, and others have also shown this, that you can detect some defects in pulmonary in systemic endothelial cell function flow-mediated vasodilatation is decreased compared with normals in patients with PAH, as is the peak forearm blood flow, and there's increase in the forearm vascular resistance. So I think to summarize, statins have multiple pleiotropic effects that would be expected to have a beneficial effect in pulmonary arterial hypertension. Animal models certainly suggest the potential for efficacy, and there's a variety of potential mechanisms, including the RORO kinase pathway, ENOS, and perhaps apoptotic pathways. And they may prove useful as adjunct in clinical therapy. I'd like to thank the NHLBI and the NIH, along with the Pulmonary Hypertension Association, Dr. Nabel mentioned the collaborative funding of for training grants between the PHA and NIH, and I was fortunate to actually be the first recipient of that award, and that's really been a tremendous help. I'd like to thank my former division chief, Skip Garcia, who actually made me aware of the pleiotropic effects of statins. I'd like to thank Drs. Ruben Tudor and Roger Johns, who served as mentors for this and provided laboratory facilities, and Dr. Paul Hassoun, who continues to provide guidance and mentorship, and Dr. Champion for some assistance with some of the work. Thank you for your attention.
Rita, that was great. Thanks. We are going to limit questions to just one or two questions because we're now running a little bit behind and we want to stay on track.
Rita, thank you very much for the very nice introduction and presentation. I wonder, I know I'm very, everyone is concerned about historical and retrospective studies, but when looking at large patient populations in the PAH field that had received statins so far, there was no clear signal whether they're going to be, you know, efficacious or not. At least they are well tolerable. I think this can be stated, as well as there is a paper already out, as I mentioned, also from the Chicago group that showed that it wasn't efficacious given to patients with severe pulmonary arterial hypertension. As you mentioned, the interaction with ENOS upregulation is very appealing in that concept. Could you speculate on the possible combination therapy with PDE5 inhibitors rather than with aspirin?
That's a great question, and would certainly warrant investigation. So we're going to be having patients that are on a variety of therapies in this trial. Perhaps we'll be able to tease that out, but I don't think that's unlikely, I think, given the number of patients. But that would make sense. You know, of course, they have effects on the suppressed endothelin too. So you could argue that we could combine it with that. I think just as a first pass, this is going to be a look to see if they're well tolerated, and perhaps we'll see some kind of signal that would form the basis for a larger trial. Or, we may, I think that could be applied in animal model too. We could look at simvastatin in combination with sildenafil, for example, to see if there's some kind of additive effect.
Great. Thanks, Rita. Our next speaker is Steve Archer, who's currently from the University of Alberta in Canada, but is on his way to be the division chief at the University of Chicago. Steve's topic is mitochondria, transcription factors, and potassium channels, new understanding of the mechanisms causing impaired apoptosis and excessive cell proliferation in PAH.
Thanks, Val. Thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me. It's a privilege to be here, and it is really encouraging to see so many people interested in this area. I give this talk on behalf of Sebastian Bonnet, who's the talented postdoc who did a lot of the work I'm going to show you on the Fonhooter rat, colleague Dr. Michalakis, who did a lot of the work on apoptosis, and that's really his primary area of expertise. And Ken Weir isn't named here, but takes some of the responsibility for planning the ideas of the mitochondrion redox signaling in my head many years ago. And the subtitle of this long talk is There and Back Again. And, of course, one of the dissatisfactions that patients have with the current status of pulmonary hypertension therapy is they really aren't cured, and so they want something better. And so the question is, can we regress from the condition as we currently know it to something that is truly normal? So it's not a disease that is much of a dread disease as it currently is. And this is controversial, and I apologize that I can't cite everyone's work in this talk, but these are some hallmarks that I would put up, and maybe to be shot down, but the things that I think actually, if you look carefully, will stand up in human forms of pulmonary hypertension, as well as in most animal models. So they're targets you can consider and reject.
that most, if not all, forms of animal pulmonary hypertension and human pulmonary arterial hypertension have decreased expression of voltage-gated potassium channels, which I'm going to try to convince you has more to do with apoptosis than with vasoconstriction, that most human and animal models have activated transcription factors, maybe not always the same one, but HIF-1-alpha, C-June, this is the work of Jason Wan, NFAT, work from Evangelos Michalakis, it's in under review, that all forms of pulmonary hypertension, like human cancer, all have hyperpolarized mitochondria. I'm making these statements purposely provocative when I say all. These hyperpolarized mitochondria have an impairment of production of reactive oxygen species, which I realize is in itself controversial, but the change in the mitochondrial function leads to something that Otto Warburg referred to when he was describing cancer. It's an impaired signaling system that relates metabolism to cell function and cell proliferation. That pulmonary hypertension is a condition of impaired apoptosis, and there are lots of people, including some in the audience like Marlene and Norbert, Jason Wan's not here, who have shown this, as well as Evangelos Michalakis, and that there are a number of cancer markers like survivin that allow the cells to escape from apoptosis. I always say this is like a faculty meeting where there's some faculty that need to be taken out and killed. And when that doesn't happen, bad things happen in your program. And in pulmonary hypertension, when you fail to kill certain cells, bad things happen in your lungs. This is a slide I show to my cardiology colleagues because they're not really interested in what I do at all. This is me talking to the average cardiologist saying, tell me again about regression of PAH, Steve. And I say, do you want the simple but misleading explanation or the one you won't understand? And he says, either one is good. I wasn't planning on listening. So the idea that pulmonary hypertension can be reversed, I think, is a very appealing idea. And it seems to most of us that it wouldn't be very likely. I mean, when you look at the disease, this is a patient who's a major leader in the pulmonary hypertension societies who has hemophilia, lives in Canada. This is his lung on gadolinium-enhanced pulmonary angiography. And there was a call that was made for better imaging of the pulmonary circulation non-invasively. And these pictures are easy to obtain with a 1.5 Tesla MRI. Gadolinium is not toxic, to my knowledge. And you can see that he's lost a lot of circulation. Radiologists used to see this on x-rays with sharper eyes than cardiologists have, but now anyone can see it. And that probably relates to lesions like this that are obstructive and obliterative. And even in this better-looking pulmonary angiogram in another patient, you can see there is cutoff of the distal pulmonary arteries. So if you have this kind of a situation, the result is this right ventricle on cardiac MRI that shows a really poor ejection fraction as the left ventricle, which is being compressed. And you could think that that's hopeless, but we learned from the work of Ken Moser in thromboembolic disease that if you take a ventricle that looks like that and do a thromboendarterectomy, that ventricle, in many cases, becomes normal as you leave the operating room. So the RV is not doing well, and it is one of the major causes of morbidity and mortality, but it may well be reversible. And in fact, if you look at the left ventricle here, if you plot the stroke volume versus the pressure, we all know that the left ventricle tolerates increased afterload very well. And I like to tell about a patient I saw who was on crack who came in with a blood pressure of 300 millimeters of mercury, you know, 280 to 300, very high with a normal ejection fraction. This person, you know, this representative trace here shows what happens in contrast to the right ventricle when pressures acutely increase, RV ejection fraction or stroke volume falls. It wouldn't take much of a change in this vascular bed to move that curve back to the left, I guess is the general theme. And there are examples of that happening. And this is one. This is, I don't know Dr. Levy, so if he or she is in the audience, you can pipe up if I get this wrong. But this is the value of a case report and a pitch that journals maybe should continue to publish them. This is a nice example of a careful clinical study in one patient. So this is relative flow in a patient that had pulmonary arterial hypertension who got a left lung transplant. And you can see that with the transplantation of a new right lung, you can see that all the blood flow went up to the right lung. And the diseased lung, which was left in situ, so it was a single lung transplant, was getting virtually no blood flow. And they did careful work at the time of the explantation of the lung, and they actually looked at the number of plexiform lesions and quantitated all that, and they showed that, at least in the explanted right lung, there were a lot of plexiform lesions. This patient did very well, and these are years, so this is 89, 96, 97. The patient got, at the end, got pneumonia, and died of immunosuppression and pneumonia. But what you can see is that over time, the left lung, which was left in place, which had pulmonary arterial hypertension, was clearly getting its own share of flow, and there was no evidence there was anything wrong with the newly transplanted or the transplanted right lung. So on autopsy, which they got, which is, again, something that unfortunately we're horrible at doing these days, on autopsy they showed that the left lung, which had been in place throughout this whole thing, was now basically not completely normal, but there was a dramatic decrease in the number of plexiform lesions, regression of intimal fibrosis. So I think it was quite a helpful study that just is one indication that maybe pulmonary arterial hypertension can be regressed. This is work from Evangelos Michalakis that is coming out in Cell Cancer, and I just want to acknowledge Norbert Vogel and Ruben Tudor for their leadership in presenting this idea, which I think Evangelos has really nailed with this paper, that there is a similarity between cancer and pulmonary arterial hypertension. So the strategies I'm going to show you that I propose as experimental therapies for pulmonary hypertension, namely dichloroacetate and drugs that affect the function of mitochondria, he took those and then applied them to human cancers. So he took glioblastoma, human, breast cancer, and lung cancer, and implanted them in immunosuppressed or nude rats, and basically found that they had the same signature that I'm going to show you in pulmonary hypertension. Here's an untreated cancer cell, and these red things are mitochondria. There's the blue nucleus. This is a membrane potential sensitive dye. The redder it is, the more hyperpolarized the membrane, which is one of these signatures that I'm going to try to persuade you occurs in pulmonary hypertension. And with the application of dichloroacetate, which blocks pyruvate dehydrogenase kinase and restores the membrane potential down to a lower level or depolarizes the mitochondrial membrane potential, as you can see in these cells, you could get regression of the tumors measured by MRI and on autopsy from this size to this size with no other therapy. And these are human tumors that otherwise just continue growing unchecked in these animals. So I was very impressed with that. So on to the K-channel story as another potential target. This I became interested in potassium channels through work that Ken and I did, showing that the initiation of hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction involved blocking K channels. The way that works is every vascular cell in your body and many others have potassium channels. There's 140 millimolar potassium inside the cell. There's 5 outside, and so there's a tonic and specific release of potassium through this channel. This keeps your membrane potential set at about minus 50, minus 60 millivolts. And that keeps the L-type calcium channel, which is voltage sensitive, closed. It only opens when the membrane potential is about minus 30 millivolts and positive to that. If you lose potassium channels, and I'm going to show you in pulmonary hypertension and in most forms of cancer, you lose potassium channels, probably due to transcription factor activation. You depolarize the membrane. The L-type calcium channel opens, calcium rises, and that can cause vasoconstriction. And that's an acute vasoreactivity model that's relevant to HPV. But what we now know is, through the work of Jason Wan, our lab, and others, that there's decreased expression of certain oxygen-sensitive potassium channels that also are targets for anorexigens, like Kv1.5. And when these things are suppressed, what happens is you get, in addition to the membrane depolarization, you get accumulation of intracellular potassium, which blocks caspases and impairs apoptosis, part of the PAH phenotype that I'd like to convince you exists. And you also have this rise in calcium, which causes activation of things like the calcineurin pathway and NFAT. So this is Jason Wan's work, which is the first demonstration to my knowledge that Kv1.5 was downregulated in human pulmonary arterial hypertension. Lou Rubin is co-author on this paper. And you can see here in this nice Lancet work in 1998 that there's a loss of Kv1.5. in PAH, and what happens, of course, when you lose that channel, which we've shown sets the membrane potential and is involved in HPV, calcium in a variety of other normal lungs or secondary pulmonary hypertension is not very high, and when you depolarize the membrane, because you lose the potassium channel, you get a rise in intracellular calcium, and you can imagine the consequences of elevated intracellular calcium, which include calcineurin activation. In a chronic hypoxic model, much the same thing happens. Here's a patch clamping experiment where you impale a pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell with a glass microelectrode. Here's a family of potassium currents. Here it is in chronic hypoxia. This occurs within a couple of days. It's reversible. The membrane potential in the PA smooth muscle cells in chronic hypoxia goes from minus 50 to about minus 30. and that's associated with, and we argue, caused by the loss of Kv1.5, the same channel involved in hypoxic constriction, the same channel that Munirex and dextenfluramine specifically bind to when it's expressed in CHO cells. So here's Western's showing the Kv1.5 expression in three control pulmonary arteries, resistance arteries, and here it is in chronic hypoxia. And this fits well with work by Smirnov, then, who was the first to show depolarization in pulmonary hypertension. So the theory would be then if the K channels are downregulated, maybe you could restore them and that would fix or improve pulmonary hypertension. So we cloned human Kv1.5 and then expressed it in rat lungs in an adenovirus, and we used the airway approach. So this is work where we nebulize it. There's the control, dark field, and you can see we put a GFP reporter, and the green fluorescence protein shows we, of course, got the airway as well as the pulmonary arteries. But the airway is a great way to treat the pulmonary artery, as many groups have shown. And here you can see robust expression of our transgene in the pulmonary artery wall, and you can see the pulmonary vascular resistance in the control, chronic hypoxic with the GFP control virus. And when you give Kv1.5 at an effective dose, you reduce pulmonary hypertension significantly. Interestingly, you restore HPV too. So most of the talk is going to be with this little fellow called the fawn hooded rat. A lot of work from Denver and other places on this before our work. What I'm going to try to convince you is these are mitochondria in the pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell. And if you don't take anything else away from this talk, one thing I would encourage you to take away is that this is a dramatic revision of what you might remember from Leninger's diagrams of the mitochondria, where there was one nucleus, one mitochondria. This is what mitochondria look like in a pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell. It's like the wiring in your house. It's everywhere. And we argue these are not only oxygen sensors, but that they're fundamentally disordered in pulmonary hypertension, causing a false redox signal that activates HIF, because this master transcription factor has the impression the cell is hypoxic when it is, in fact, normoxic based on PO2, but hypoxic based on a deficiency of ROS. And that the K-channel story that I told you is downstream of all this, of an impaired oxygen sensor, an activated transcription factor. That's what leads to the potassium channel problem. It's been known for some time that fawn-hooded rats are the only animals that spontaneously get pulmonary hypertension other than humans. And here's some catheterization work that Sean McMurtry did, showing PA pressure in normal rats with Mylar catheters, fawn-hooded rats at 20 weeks, and fawn-hooded rats at 40 weeks. They develop pulmonary hypertension faster in Denver, maybe because it's at a higher altitude, but they certainly spontaneously develop pulmonary hypertension in Edmonton without any help. And if you look at their pulmonary resistance, it's increased. They don't have systemic hypertension. There are many strains of fawn-hooded rats, and you have to be careful which ones you're getting. These ones don't develop elevated creatinine or evidence of glomerular nephritis, and they don't develop systemic hypertension. Interestingly, they did develop mild polycythemia in normoxia, which I don't think has been reported before, and as you'll see, goes away with mitochondrial therapy. So, of course, now, finally, the non-cognitive specialty of cardiology has a role, because we get to use our clinical skills on rats. So this is the normal rat ventricle, and there's the pulmonary hypertensive rat ventricle, which just looks exactly like a human being. And I mentioned in the echo talks, this is PA Doppler, you know, from it looks just like human pulmonary artery Doppler, nice waveform and nice slow peak. And you can see the velocity drops and the peak occurs earlier, and there's notching reflecting the reflected wave coming off the pulmonary circulation. So PA acceleration time, at least in rodents, is a very useful way to monitor their pulmonary hypertension. So we did that in fawn-hooded rats while we watched them age and develop pulmonary hypertension. So this is now a natural history study, and we were lucky. There's a Dr. Jacobs in Wisconsin that some of you may know who developed consomic animals. So these are animals identical to the fawn-hooded rats, except through microsatellite selection, he was able to swap chromosome 1. So now we have a fawn-hooded rat except for chromosome 1, which is a brown Norway chromosome 1. And what you can see is when you take this consomic control and watch the pulmonary artery acceleration time as a non-invasive measure of PA pressure so you don't have to kill the animals, it doesn't change as they go from age 12 weeks to 40 weeks. Whereas the fawn-hooded rat, it gets shorter and shorter as their PA pressure, which we confirmed by cath, goes up. Again, the only difference, at least that we know of, is the swap of chromosome 1. And if you look at RVH, you can see the fawn-hooded rats get RVH as they age, and the consomics don't. And what's remarkable, too, is that I'm going to show you the mitochondrial problem is already present here at 12 weeks when they're hemodynamically normal. And here's a picture of that showing EM, showing the normal mitochondria. And here are the fawn-hooded rat mitochondria. Some people think that the Fonda-Durrett is a model of Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome, which is a disease in which the humans get, in which there's impaired organellogenesis. So it may not just be mitochondria that are abnormal, and I was hearing some interesting stuff about snares and snaps and Golgis, and maybe those organelles are abnormal too, I don't know. But these mitochondria are clearly abnormal. They have increased intercrystal space, they're small and hyperdense. And functionally, they're abnormal. This is two-photon microscopy of the actual arterial wall. The nice thing about two-photon is you don't have to necessarily always dissociate cells. So this is TMRM. The mitochondria are the most negative organelles in the cell, so all this dye gets sucked in there, and the redder it is, the more hyperpolarized they are. So you can see that Fonda-Durrett pulmonary artery cells are, and this is the smooth muscle there, are much more hyperpolarized than the controls, either sphragdolites or the consomic controls. I'm not going to go into the details, but we're doing native blue gels. They have very different expression of electron transport chain components. So if you then say, well, what are the consequences of having these abnormal mitochondria? Here's the measurement of oxygen radicals in the mitochondria using mitosox. So again, this is an ethidium dye that gets trafficked into the mitochondria, and when it gets oxidized, it turns red. The Fonda-Durrett's have much less of this than the consomic controls in their pulmonary arteries and muscle cells. And if you look at hydrogen peroxide production, whereas a normal rat makes a fair bit of hydrogen peroxide and that's inhibited by hypoxia, the Fonda-Durrett makes much less hydrogen peroxide. This is measured using amplex red, and it's no longer oxygen sensitive. The consequence then of having abnormal mitochondria and not making reactive oxygen species is you think you're hypoxic. So this involves now a massive induction into the redox theory of life, but there's a normal PA smooth muscle cell. Every single Fonda-Durrett cell has HIF in the nucleus, and when HIF moves to the nucleus, that means it's turned on. Cytosolic HIF doesn't mean much, and there's not much of it, but when it goes to the nucleus, that's activation. And you can see, unlike the consomics, there's a lot of HIF, and Norbert was kind enough to show this picture, which is a human pulmonary artery showing all these HIF-positive cells in a human PA section from, an autopsy. So HIF is on. Well, is HIF important? Is that the reason that K channels are down? Does that explain Smirnov's 1994 observation of depolarized pulmonary arteries with muscle cells? I think the answer is an overwhelming yes. Here's the lack of HIF in a normal pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell. Here's every single nucleus in a Fonda-Durrett culture positive for HIF despite normal PO2. Lots of Kv1.5 in red in the control cells, very little in the Fonda-Durrett cells. So then, if you simply give hydrogen peroxide, if that's like replacement therapy for these animals, you can see the HIF, which was there, is now largely inactivated, and the Kv1.5, which wasn't there, is now largely back. Not that I'm proposing to give hydrogen peroxide. However, you could knock down HIF with a variety of different drugs, and here's what happens when you make a dominant negative version of HIF, and you can see these cells as a GFP reporter, so the green cells are the ones that got the dominant negative HIF, and they're the ones that regrew Kv1.5. So when it does seem that HIF is causing the K channels to go down, and temporarily HIF is turned on about 20 weeks, K channels don't go down to about 40 weeks. So here's Kv1.5 at 12, 20, and finally suppressed at 40 weeks. Kv3.1, much the same. As much as I love potassium channels, they seem to be, it's a late phenomenon. It seems to be downstream from the transcription factors. I won't go through the rest of that for purposes of time. What I found most amazing and exciting were these pictures. These are pictures of normal human pulmonary arteries, smooth muscle cells obtained at lobectomy, and you can see the mitochondrial reticulum here stained with SOD2 or manganese SOD, which is only in the mitochondria. First, it's just amazing how pretty the network is and how delicate it is and how different than what I thought it would look like. But what was really surprising is when we took idiopathic pulmonary arterial hypertension cells and looked at them, they really look a lot like the Fonda-Durrett cells. They don't have a reticulum. They have sort of globular mitochondria that are clearly dysmorphic, and they don't have as much superoxide dismutase too. This is the Fonda-Durrett, but it's true in humans, and actually Norbert had shown this in plexiform lesions. I just hadn't been aware of it. And the hydrogen peroxide production is down as a result of losing this enzyme that converts superoxide to hydrogen peroxide. So we're almost done. So this is, again, our clinical skills as cardiologists. We have our rats running on treadmills, and you can tell which ones are the healthy ones because they're the ones that avoid. There's a little shocker bar that delivers a shock. You don't leave them on to get many shocks, but that's what motivates them. And then the healthy ones are at the front, and the not healthy ones lag behind over time. So you can do the equivalent of a six-minute walk with your rodents. And this is the exercise time, and these are animals who, this is not published, but it's going to be submitted soon, hopefully. This is manganese TDAP, which is a replacement for superoxide manganese SOD. And you can see the animals that had established proven pulmonary hypertension by echo and cath gradually increased their walking time when they were given manganese TBAP, whereas the vehicle-treated animals got worse over the 3 weeks of therapy. And these are the hemodynamic correlates. This is very similar to dichloroacetate, which is another drug that is effective. Then we did CT scans on these animals. This is CT angiography in the animal when it had the von Hutter rat with pulmonary hypertension, and this is the same type of animal treated with the manganese TBAP. And so you can see the vasculature regrowing. So maybe that hope of regressing pulmonary hypertension is not pie in the sky. And if it lets me move. Okay, so there's one other therapy I wanted to show you, because I really think this could be clinically trialed, and I know Dr. Michalakis would like to do this study, and maybe we can get funding for it at some point. Dichloroacetate is a prototypic inhibitor of pyruvate dehydrogenase kinase, and the net effect of this is to increase mitochondrial NADH. Mitochondrial NADH is the electron donor that passes electrons. This is probably painful for the physicians, because this reminds me of medical school first year. But anyway, passes the electrons to complex 1 and then down the chain. As each electron passes, hydrogen is pumped out, creating the membrane potential of the mitochondria. But at the same time, there is some inefficiency in this process, and there's production of uncoupled transport resulting in superoxide production. And that's why the mitochondria has superoxide dismutases, to get rid of those few oxygen radicals that are produced. And the result is you produce, instead of something that's within the mitochondria, something that we've proven, although not published, can get out of the mitochondria, hydrogen peroxide, which we argue is the signaling molecule, and it modulates K channels. So in any case, when you give dichloroacetate, you fix a problem that is occurring in the mitochondria, and you restore the production of hydrogen peroxide, depolarize the membrane potential, you cause some release of cytochrome C, which causes apoptosis. This only happens in abnormal cells, however, not in normal cells. And if you, in fact, give dichloroacetate, which has been used in human heart failure trials, it's been used in kids with mitochondrial diseases, so there's a big study published in the New England Journal using dichloroacetate to treat kids with mitochondrial diseases, so it's relatively safe. You can see here's the controlled PA pressures in a rat. Here's a rat with chronic hypoxic pulmonary hypertension that Evangelos did. Here's the dichloroacetate treated animal. This is just a drug, small molecule, given in the drinking water. And you can see this causes regression of pulmonary vascular resistance. Here's the control. Here's the DCA. Here's the hypertensive animal. Same with RBH. And how does that happen? Well, it restores K-channel expression. If you use laser capture microdissection, a very useful technique, you can take out the artery and prove that that artery that was abnormally remodeled was deficient in KV 1.5 and 2.1, and that when the animal drank dichloroacetate, that was restored. And what's the consequence of giving back those K-channels is that you cause apoptosis. So here's the apoptosis in tunnel in green and PCNA in blue, and what you can see is the animal that didn't get dichloroacetate that had monocrotaline in this case has no apoptosis going on, which is true in humans and other models, and lots of apoptosis here when you give DCA, but only in cells that have abnormal mitochondria, so it doesn't do a darn thing to a normal pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell. So is there convergence of theory? And I apologize to Drs. Young, Wigenberg, and Michalakis, and Juan, whose work I'm not showing, but I'm delighted that they all looked at this. The BMPR2-dominant negative that's my Canadian background. BMPR2-dominant negative mice have KV1.5 downregulation. That's a very nice paper showing that. The serotonin transporter overexpressor has decreased KV1.5 expression. The survive and overexpressing rats have decreased KV1.5 expression. I think it's a downstream marker, but I think now there's enough people's work, in addition to our work and Jason's work and Lou's work, showing that is true. So strategies to conclude, maybe we should try to increase potassium channel expression. That could be direct or metabolic in terms of how we accomplish it. Inhibit transcription factors, which will also tend to do this. Block HIF, maybe as Jason might suggest, block C-June, or as Evangelist suggests, block NFAT. Normalize mitochondrial function. I think DCA, although it may cause some neuropathic problems, is worth a trial. So the dream is regressing TAH. Are we close? Well, be careful what you dream. This is me here with my dream. But, hey, I guess this is the price you pay for dreaming. So I'm sure the question period I'll have my head removed. But in any case, I'd like to acknowledge the people that should be decapitated along with me, notably Dr. Michalakis and Dr. Bonet. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Archer, for this very elegant and colorful presentation. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, there's only place for one question.
Steve, very nice. Can you at least discuss why you think that HIF-1-alpha is upregulated? Is that primarily a mitochondrial dysfunction? Why this would happen over time in a PH patient if, you know, we know that patients don't start with a mitochondria that is intrinsically abnormal? So how this would, you know, develop and eventually translate in terms of HIF-1 stabilization?
Yeah, the honest answer is I don't know why PAH patients develop their mitochondria. Once they have the mitochondrial problem, it's easy to explain why HIF would be activated. In fact, Greg Simmons has also published before us that hydrogen peroxide turns HIF off. And so conversely, loss of hydrogen peroxide would turn HIF on. So whether... But what causes it, I don't know. I mean, what we found in the fawn hood rats by doing serial microarrays is that they have an early downregulation of something called, of the SOD2 gene. So maybe PAH patients have some problem with SOD2, that the geneticists like Jane Morse and Dr. Lloyd and others could look at. The other thing we found is an early observation is they have downregulation of something called TFAM, which is a mitochondrial biogenesis factor. So I don't know. And the broiler fowl, these are chickens that grow, that eat too much and grow too fast and develop pulmonary hypertension. They have a mitochondrial disease too. So, I mean, it is odd to think of pulmonary hypertension as a mitochondrial disease, but the way we got into this was that the fawn hooded rats have impaired oxygen sensing. They have impaired HPV. And it just seems to me that it's got to be more than a coincidence that you've lost HPV, you've lost oxygen-sensitive K channels, the same channels that anorexigens target, and that somehow seems to be going on in pulmonary hypertension. So I don't know what the fundamental cause is, but I think it's worth looking at to see which gene is driving this. It's somewhere on chromosome 1 in the fawn hooded rat.
Thank you very much. I'm sure there would be many more questions, but we have to move on, and it's a pleasure to introduce Serge Ratneau from the Medical School of Créteil Henri Mondor à Paris. And Serge is one of the pioneers in the serotonin pathway field and its involvement in pulmonary arterial hypertension. And we're looking forward to your presentation, Serge. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So first, I would like to thank the organizers of the meeting. It's really a great pleasure for me to be here in such a very famous area. So... As it has been mentioned by many speakers, the mechanisms leading to smooth muscle cell proliferation during pulmonary hypertension is not very well understood, and in particular, it is not known whether it is due to an inherent characteristic of the cell or a secondary response to external stimuli. So to resolve this issue, we investigated cultured cells obtained from patients with IPH on controls, and to question whether these cells still exhibit an abnormal phenotype while being studied in vitro. So we presume that if functional abnormalities are still detected in these cells in vitro, it is likely that the molecular alterations supporting these abnormalities are closely linked to the pathogenesis of pulmonary hypertension. So first, we will look at the behavior of smooth muscle cells, and this is a growth of pulmonary arterial smooth muscle cell from patients with IPH and controls, And as you can see, these cells grow faster than those from controls when stimulated by serum or by serotonin or by endothelin 1, but not by overgrowth factors such as EGF, FGFA, TGF-beta, or PDGF. Now, this increased responsiveness to serotonin is due to overexpression of the serotonin transporter, which mediates the mitogenic action of the indoleamine. And so the higher the expression of the transporter, the greater the growth-promoting effect of serotonin. And so you can inhibit the transporter with either citalopram or fluoxetine. And as you can see here, the growth response to serotonin can be completely abolished with this drug. Now, the serotonin transporter is overexpressed not only during idiopathic pulmonary hypertension, but also in smooth muscle cells from patients with various forms of pulmonary hypertension. And so this is a growth response to fetal serum of smooth muscle cells obtained from patients with various associated forms of pulmonary hypertension, pulmonary veno-occlusive disease, and patients with idiopathic pulmonary hypertension. So as you can see, the growth response to serum is markedly increased in these patients as compared to controls. Now, if you treat these cells with citalopram, which inhibits the serotonin transporter, you get a small decrease in the growth response induced by serum in the control, but you get a marked inhibition of cells from patients with PH, and it's such a way that the difference between controls and patients is no longer observed when these cells are treated with citalopram. Now, overexpression of the transporter also occurred in various forms of experimental pulmonary hypertension. This is what happens after injection of monocrotalin. There is a rapid rise of the serotonin transporter, which precedes the rise in pulmonary artery pressure. So if you treat these animals with fluoxetine, you completely prevent the development of pulmonary hypertension. So you can prevent the development of pulmonary hypertension when you give fluoxetine initially after monocrotaline injection, but you can also reverse completely the pulmonary hypertension when the treatment with fluoxetine is started 3 weeks after monocrotaline injection. Now, we also question whether overexpression of the serotonin transporter would be sufficient to induce pulmonary hypertension in mice. And so we developed transgenic mice overexpressing the serotonin transporter selectively in smooth muscle cells under the control of the SM22 promoter. So as you can see, these mice exhibit a high level of the serotonin transporter in the lung, which is very close to the level seen in patients with PH. And interestingly, these mice spontaneously develop pulmonary hypertension, which is due to smooth muscle cell proliferation and therefore to vascular remodeling. And I could say that at the present time, these mice have even a more severe PH phenotype, and the pulmonary artery pressure is usually close to 50, 60 millimeters of mercury. So alteration of only one molecule on smooth muscle cells can lead to a development of pulmonary hypertension. So interestingly, these mice do not exhibit changes in the expression of genes belonging to the BMP pathway, and they do not exhibit changes in genes expressed by endothelial cells, such as endothelin 1, TIE2, or PGI2 synthase. However, they show a marked reduction in the potassium channel, the 1.5 and 2.1 in the lung, and we found that in fact treatment with serotonin of pulmonary artery smooth muscle cells were associated with a marked down regulation of this channel, which was not observed when serotonin was given simultaneously to an inhibitor of the serotonin transporter. So we question whether these mice, these transgenic mice, which have low levels of this potassium channel, whether this could be reversed by treating them with fluoxetine or dichloroacetate. And as you can see here, treatments with fluoxetine or dichloroacetate increase the level of the potassium channel and even to almost to a normal level. And it is interesting that a reversal of pulmonary hypertension in these mice could be obtained after treatment with either fluoxetine or dichloroacetate. So this is the right ventricular systolic pressure and the right ventricular hypertrophy index. So it's possible that fluoxetine may work at least partially through overexpression of the potassium channel. Now, so pulmonary artery smooth muscle cells from patients with IPH exhibit molecular alteration, and some of these molecular alterations may be linked. So it is still unexplained why the serotonin transporter is overexpressed in these cells. And we initially questioned whether polymorphism could explain this overexpression. As you know, there is a functional polymorphism, which is located on the promoter of this gene with a long allele leading to a high transcription rate. So the LL genotype, when we study cells from LL subjects, show a higher level of serotonin transporter, and so these smooth muscle cells grow faster when stimulated with serotonin. So we initially questioned whether the LL genotype would be higher in patients with IPH, and we showed a high prevalence of this LL genotype initially in a population of patients with IPH, and this was not confirmed by other studies. And possibly because in this study there were some lung transplanted patients with PH, and in fact we confirmed that in this particular population the prevalence of the LL genotype is very high. So maybe the LL genotype is not a susceptibility factor to develop pulmonary hypertension, but rather an aggravating factor. And this was also confirmed by a study we recently achieved. We studied 148 patients with COPD who underwent right heart catheterization. And as you can see here, the patients with the LL genotype had a higher pulmonary artery pressure than the those with the other genotype. And we also found that the pulmonary hypertension in these patients was closely linked to polymorphism of the IL-6 gene. And so patients with the 5-HTT LL genotype and combined to IL-6 GG genotype are more likely to develop pulmonary hypertension when they have COPD. Now, another question we addressed recently was whether these alterations could be linked to BMPR2 dysfunction, and we had the opportunity to study cells from patients exhibiting a BMPR2 mutation. So we had not such results concerning the 5-HTT in these cells, but we observed some very interesting results regarding the ETR receptor. As you can see here, this is the increased expression of the ETA receptor in smooth muscle cell from patients with IPH as compared to controls. And as you can see, in cells harboring a mutation in the BMPR2, the expression of ETA receptor is markedly increased, a finding which is not observed for ETB receptor. So if you stimulate these cells with endothelin 1, as you can see, the proliferation induced by endothelin 1, which is not very important in patients with IPH, is become more marked in patients with IPH above, with a BMPR2 mutation. And this is completely suppressed by an antagonist of the ETR receptor. Now, some interaction exists between BMPR2 and the serotonin transporter. As you know, BMPR2 deficient mice do not spontaneously develop pulmonary hypertension, and they do not also develop more severe pulmonary hypertension than controls when they are exposed to chronic hypoxia. However, they develop more severe pulmonary hypertension than controls when they are treated with serotonin, and it was proposed by, observed by the team of Nick Morrell, But serotonin through the transporter could not only lead to mitogenic signals, but also inhibited the phosphorylation of SMAD, thereby suppressing an anti-mitogenic signal. So there is a rationale to inhibit the serotonin transporter during pulmonary hypertension. And a study, a clinical study is presently underway in France. It's a pilot study which should include 34 patients and to evaluate the efficacy of this drug on the 6-minute walking test. I would say that this study is only supported by a public grant, so it goes very slowly, and at the present time only 10 patients have been included. So smooth muscle cells exhibit an abnormal phenotype, and this is also the case for endothelial cells. So I would like to come back to some behavior of endothelial cells, and this is to recall some aspect of angiogenesis which were also shown yesterday by Patricia Titulwev. And as you know, there are two phases in angiogenesis, an activation phase during which endothelial cells migrate, proliferate to form new vessels, and this phase is under the control of VEGF, and there is a resolution phase during which the endothelial cells become quiescent and recruit peri-endothelial support cells, and this phase is under the control of various factors, among those the angiopoietin 1 type 2 pathway and the TGF-beta ILK1 pathway. So this is interesting because when these cells are quiescent, that means that they can release maybe growth factors to recruit smooth muscle cells and form a smooth muscle cell coat surrounding vessels. So we question whether endothelial cells could release growth factors acting on smooth muscle cells, and to this end, we added the medium from endothelial cells to pulmonary artery smooth muscle cells. If we do that, we obtain a huge increase in smooth muscle cell proliferation. So really, these cells proliferate in response to growth factors released from endothelial cells. And this effect is more important when we use the medium from endothelial cells collected from patients with pulmonary hypertension. Now, if we use smooth muscle cell from patients with pulmonary hypertension, this effect is even more marked. So during pulmonary hypertension, there is an increased release of growth factors from endothelial cells, and there is an increased responsiveness of smooth muscle cells to these growth factors. Now, which growth factors are involved? And indeed, we tested whether endothelin 1 and serotonin could be involved, so we treated these cells with a combination of fluoxetine and ETA receptor antagonist. And as you can see, we obtained a 50% inhibition of the growth response of smooth muscle cells stimulated by the medium of endothelial cells. So this is interesting because it may suggest that serotonin can be synthesized in endothelial cells, and indeed, the rate-limiting enzyme to synthesize serotonin is tryptophan hydroxylase. And as you can see here, the tryptophan hydroxylase 1 is exclusively expressed by endothelial cells, so serotonin is released and acts on the smooth muscle cell, which exhibit expression of the serotonin transporter. So the same would be true with endothelin 1. Endothelin 1 is synthesized by endothelial cells. Its release is increased during pulmonary hypertension, and the ETA receptor is overexpressed in smooth muscle cells. So both these systems work to increase smooth muscle cell proliferation. So we confirmed that indeed there were serotonin was synthesized in the lung using studying mice, and this is the serotonin level in the gut, in the lung, and in the forebrain of mice, of white-type mice in yellow. And you can see there are huge amounts of serotonin in the lung. And if you use a TPH1 deficient mice, this is markedly decreased. And in these mice, here are protected against development of pulmonary hypertension, and you can get an additional decrease if you treat them with PCPA, which is an inhibitor of tryptophan hydroxylase, showing that not only the TPH1 isoform, but the neuronal TPH2 isoform are working in this process. Now, endothelin 1 and serotonin are not the only growth factors released from endothelial cells. There are many other factors which are shown here by differential proteomic analysis. And at the present time, we identified a few factors released by endothelial cells, such as some cytokines, MCP1 and IL-6, and some growth factors such as BFGF, which, as you can see, is markedly is released in large quantities from endothelial cells from patients with IPH as compared to controls. Endothelial cells also sensitize PDGF, but there is no difference between patients with IPH and controls. So this is interesting because in a therapeutic point of view, this may provide a rationale to combine therapies inhibiting the effect of these growth factors individually. I mean endothelin receptor antagonists, serotonin transporter inhibitors, and PDGF receptor inhibitors for antagonists, for example. Now, another way maybe to question why these endothelial cells exhibit an abnormal phenotype in vitro. And as I mentioned earlier, and which was shown yesterday by Patricia Titelweth, the angiopoietin-1 system stimulates endothelial cells as well as the TGF-beta-ALK1 endoglin systems. So we question whether this system could lead to the overexpression of these growth factors. And indeed, endothelial cells from patients with IPH overexpress the TIE2 receptor. So if you put angiopoietin-1 on endothelial cells from controls and patients with IPH, and then take this medium to stimulate pulmonary artery smooth muscle cell growth, as you can see, this is stimulated by angiopoietin-1, suggesting that the increased activity of the angiopoietin-1 TIE2 system contribute to the to this effect. Now, this is just to show that angiopoietin-1 leads to the increased release of serotonin and of endothelin-1, but not of EGF or PDGF, for example. Now, the TGF-beta-ALK1 endocrine receptor tumor also work in the same fashion. And one current hypothesis in the lab is that this system may be very important for vessels to form a smooth muscle cell coat. So that means that, for example, in case of a loss of function of ALK1, such as it occurs in HHT, pulmonary vessels may be may not be able to form a smooth muscle cell coat, so this may lead to a dilation of the vessels in response to flow and pressure. And so maybe the opposite occurs in pulmonary hypertension, and indeed, endothelial cells from patients with IPH exhibit a high expression of ALK1. No ALK1 is found in smooth muscle cells, and they also exhibit a high expression of endoglin, which is part of this receptor. So one current hypothesis is that overexpression of this system may overstimulate the release of these growth factors, and therefore leads to a smooth muscle cell proliferation in pulmonary hypertension. So it was my last slide, and I have to thank all the people from the team, and especially Sadia Idaibi, who is now at the head of the team, and all the people we are collaborate with, and notably Marc Amber at the the Hôpital Antoine Becler in Clamart, and Elie Fadel, who is a surgeon, who provided all the lung samples. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Serge. We are again running just a little bit over, and so we have time for just one question or so, if anyone from the audience has a question. Francisco.
Good morning. Great presentation. Could you, the sample size that you have for your study, for your step, it's relatively small, so I'm wondering if you're anticipating a major treatment effect, which is one of the ways you can get away with this. And the question is, do you have any preliminary data of a few case series or something? Just giving you a guesstimate of how much improvement in 6-minute walk test have you seen or anticipate to find in a patient who gets citalopram with PH?
I don't know. I don't know. In fact, we have only some case report. I mean, some colleagues who gave the drug sometimes with some really important improvement, but we started on an improvement of 50 meters, I think.
50?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was in one case?
No, but I mean to calculate the number of subjects we needed to the pilot study.
But that was not based.
This is what we expect.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Serge.